listening to me, Emily Thornberry, standing in for James O'Brien until 1 o'clock. The Australian government say that they're not going to be bullied out of taking action by social media giants following a planned ban for the under-16s. Do you want the UK to follow in the same steps? How much more evidence do we need that social media is bad for young minds? And from 11, we know that he didn't come good on fixing the war in his first 24 hours, but will Donald Trump finally broker a peace for Ukraine? But first, every summer for the last few years, the number of asylum hotels has increased, except for this year, where the numbers have gone down. But there still seems to be lots of people protesting outside them. So why is this?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the energy regulator Ofgem has confirmed a larger than expected increase in its price cap this winter. It's been driven by volatility in the wholesale gas market, alongside an increase in costs to cover a discount for low-income households. A typical bill will rise by 2%, or about £3 a month, from October. The Lib Dem MP, Sarah Olney, says there needs to be more investment in renewables.
I mean, I think this will be a blow to families and particularly pensioners up and down the country, because the last thing that households need right now is higher energy bills this winter. The Liberal Democrats are saying that the government should cancel this rise. They should take up the plan that we've put forward to halve energy bills instead.
The government says it's investing in more clean energy to help bring down prices. The Cabinet Office Minister Nick Thomas-Symonds has accused Reform UK of seeking to take Britain backwards. He's pushed back against Nigel Farage's call to tear up a temporary deal with the EU, reducing border checks on food and drink. Mr Thomas-Symonds is looking to secure a permanent post-Brexit agreement by 2027. He says closer alignment on EU rules is a necessary step.
We are also taking a choice that we are aligning with high standards. We're not interested in a race to the bottom. And we're doing it, frankly, because this is in the interest of businesses and reducing costs up and down the country. And also because it's happening anyway and we're getting no benefit.
Charities say more than 6 million new cancer cases could be diagnosed in England over the next 15 years. That works out at one every 2 minutes. LBC's Tom Harrigan reports.
One Cancer Voice, a group of organisations including Cancer Research UK and Macmillan, says there have been around 5.5 million cases of the disease in the last 15 years. But it expects that figure to rise by nearly 15% come 2040. It wants the government to make 6 changes that would see England become a world leader in cancer care, including better screening. The Department of Health insists it's prioritising cancer and is working on a national plan.
Royal Mail is rolling out what's been described as the biggest change to post boxes in 175 years. There'll be about 3,500 with an app-controlled drawer for customers to send parcels as large as a shoebox. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 92.75. That's up 10. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, many places seeing a mixture of sunshine and showers, some heavier rain moving northeastwards across the country. A high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Summer's best bits: relaxing on beaches, catching up with friends and family. And here's another summer highlight. Right now with SEAT Summer Savings, you get £500 off the SEAT range on top of existing offers. Just order and take delivery by the 30th of September. SEAT Summer Savings, now on.
T's and C's and exclusions apply. UK retail customers 18 plus. Excludes SEAT Ibiza. New stock vehicles only, subject to availability. Saving including VAT applied to on the road price.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Emily Thornberry.
Good morning. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. I'm standing in for James O'Brien on LBC until 1 o'clock today. So we've got a number of things we want to talk about this morning. The first thing is about asylum hotels. Like, why is it all kicking off now? Why are people so angry at the moment about it? But let me just also tell you what else we're going to do. So in the second hour, I thought we would talk about Ukraine. We know that Donald Trump promised to fix it within the first 24 hours of being elected, and clearly he's not exactly delivered on that. But is he going to be able to deliver on peace? Is he able to focus on the details? What's his relationship with Putin? Does he have the strength? Does he have the stamina? What do you think? What's the future for Ukraine? We'll be talking about that at 11 o'clock. And at 12 o'clock, Australia has decided to ban social media accounts for everybody under 16. And they're doing it, obviously, in the teeth of opposition from the media companies. There's lots of evidence about the bad effects of social media on young minds. What do we think we should be doing in Britain? Might we look back in a few years' time and think we've made a terrible mistake and we should have restricted it more? Interestingly, Gen Z seems to have strong views about it, but let's talk about this at 12 o'clock. Until then, let's talk about asylum hotels. It's odd. The number of asylum hotels has gone down from 400 to 200. The government does seem to be doing as much as it can in many ways. It's already returned 35,000. It's got a whole lot of new policies. It's got returns agreements. It's trying to get through the backlog left by the Conservatives. And yet this is the summer when there are so many protests against the asylum hotels. Why is that? Why do you think it is? Is it because you've just had enough? You've been putting up with it for too long and now is the time when enough is enough? Or is it because there are politicians such as Robert Jenrick or Nigel Farage who talk about that and not much else and this is their big issue and they come up with kind of what seem to be fairly simple solutions to it? Is it because the media are not talking about anything else? And listen, I'm as guilty as anyone else. I've put it in my first hour of time on LBC. But I'd like to know what it is that people think, because it is something that we are all discussing. The things that the government has done, they've had a massive raid in Belgium where they've picked up a huge shipment of small boats. They've stopped 12,000 crossings by working with the French. They've got this returns pilot with the French. They've got this borders bill where they're going to introduce counterterrorism powers for small gangs. They've got a sanctions regime against smugglers. They're going to look again at the ECHR and work with Europe on potentially amending it. They've got international intelligence agreements with India, with Bulgaria, with Romania. They've got a joint action plan with Vietnam. I mean, it's boring. There's lots of detail, but they are trying. So, I mean, is it because it isn't exciting enough? Is it because the government's not explaining well enough what it is that they're doing? Or is it that they're missing the obvious and there is something else that should be done? Let's move to Ray in Whitstable. Hello, Ray. You're on LBC.
Hello. This rioting now is a direct result of a Labour government being elected.
Okay.
Now, when there were 400 hotels 2 years ago, there was no right-wing rioting.
No.
When the number of boats rose in 2020 to a record, there was no rioting at all.
Mm.
But as soon as the Labour government got elected, the right wing could not accept that you now have a government that is to the left or to the centre, not to the right. And the right-wing press and that frog-faced fascist have stirred everyone up to riot on the streets, commit crimes, and riot against this government. And the whole of the right-wing press now are blaming this government for the things they did.
Well, you're speaking my language. I mean, there's one thing that the Conservatives did do properly when they were in government. They introduced a returns agreement with Albania so they could send people back to Albania. But otherwise, I don't know what they were doing. You know, when they negotiated Brexit, they seemed to overlook the fact that they needed to have something to replace the Dublin Agreement. You know, the Dublin Agreement where if you've applied for asylum somewhere else in Europe and then you fail and you then come over to the UK, we were able to send people back. But after we left the European Union, that agreement lapsed and they didn't have anything to replace it. It's as if Boris Johnson campaigns for Brexit on the basis that he wants to control our borders and then forgets about it on Christmas Eve when he signs the Brexit agreement. I mean, they just let us down so badly, I think.
Well, not only that, you had the Rwanda scheme,
yes,
which wasted £750 million and would only have sent back 300 a year, 1% of the people that come over, not the 100% this idiotic shadow cabinet is now trying to claim. And a lot of the reason why they're in hotels is because the Conservatives put them in hotels.
That's right.
The Labour government didn't put them in hotels. The Conservatives did. And you now have the right-wing press jumping all over Keir Starmer. It's only been in 13 months to solve the problem that the previous government created.
Of course, the irony is that one of the people who were signing up these contracts with these hotels was the very Robert Jenrick, who's now making such a fuss about it. And these contracts were done in a panic. They weren't negotiated properly, and they started putting people into hotels because they did have them in a detention camps. They had them in Marsden, you remember, and there was disease starting, and there were women and children in these camps, and they just got into a panic and just thought we'd better get them out. Started putting them in hotels, but they weren't doing anything about it. I mean, it went up to £9 million a day spending on hotels, and yet they still have the audacity to lecture us.
I know it's come down. It was 400 and it's now 210.
That's right.
And it is falling, and there's 54,000, there's now 32. But it doesn't matter to the right wing, because facts don't matter to them at all.
I don't
care about facts and figures. It's all about emotion and stirring up basically racial hatred against 30,000 people or 40,000 who came over in boats.
Yeah.
That's all it's about. You're stirring up absolute nonsense. Just the same as the Nazis did in Germany in the 1930s. It's exactly the same rhetoric and exactly the same racist drivel that comes out of the right-wing press and incites people to write, not helped by that idiotic Reform Party and the morons who vote Reform, not helped by them, who incite, in some cases, decent people, as we know, in Nazi Germany, not everyone was a Nazi. There were decent people in Germany, and the right wing takes over with the drivel and the nonsense they come out, not based on any facts or any figures, based on basically racial hatred. And you see what happens in this country now, why you've got all this in this country.
Well, don't hold back, Ray.
I'm not going to hold back. They're always going about freedom of speech, aren't they, the right wing?
Yeah, I
hear you. They're allowed to have freedom of speech, and especially when you saw last year with the right wing scum that rioted on our street a year ago. As we now know, 40% of them have been reported for domestic abuse. But who is safe around women and children? Are you safe around people who are in boats or right wing scum that go home and then beat their wife up?
I think the other thing which really struck me when I was looking into this was, you remember when the Conservatives passed the Illegal Migration Act? So they said anybody coming over in a boat is come here illegally, and there's no way that they're going to be allowed to have their case heard. They're not going to be allowed to claim asylum. And so they just put them into limbo, and they built up 26,000 of them. And they, you know, there was Rwanda, as you were saying, but it was hardly going to take anybody. And there was this, and there was, they just did not have a solution as to what they were going to do with the 26,000 who were just sitting in asylum hotels. And it was almost as if, well, if we can't have Rwanda, we haven't got a solution. And that's that. And we're just going to wait for an election. And the new Labour government's going to have to pick up this. I just feel sometimes that it was as irresponsible as that. I mean, I have a couple of asylum hotels in my constituency, and people from those hotels would come and see me. And they were saying, we want a decision made. And no one was making a decision on their case. They were just sitting there, holding their breath, waiting for their life to start, waiting to be able to be heard so that they could, because they believed that they were entitled to asylum because of the way they'd been treated in Afghanistan or Iran or, you know, the various countries that they'd come from. But they just couldn't get a decision made because the Home Office basically said, no, we're not, no, la, 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 we're not going to do anything with you because you came over in a small boat and we're not listening to what it is that you have to say.
Well, I mean, Keir Starmer's only had 30 months, and apparently he should have sorted all the mess out. Apparently, in 13 months, he hasn't done enough, whereas the previous morons had 14 years to ruin this country, ruin everything, you know, the health service and every other thing that they ruined.
Courts, he's only had 13 prisons. Months. I mean, just there's so many
everything.
Things they just wouldn't make decisions about.
He's had 13 months, and they're all complaining, oh, he hasn't sorted it out yet. It's going to take years to sort out the mess that those idiots left behind.
Well, look, Ray, thank you very much for ringing in. Give my love to Whitstable. You're from a wonderful part of the country. Let me go to Tyler in Leeds.
Hey, Ms. Farnbury, thank you for taking my call. Firstly, I think you are correct. I think the Labour Party are doing a lot of things that people are asking to sort of reduce the problems, like you mentioned about closing that camp that the Conservatives had set up. However, I think what a lot of people are concerned about, and I think that even if they are explaining this is the way a lot of people feel. Yeah, the Labour Party is following the narrative of reform about how immigrants and foreign people coming over is like perhaps a negative. And I'd suggest that it'd be really positive for you and the taxpayer and for farms if you encouraged, instead of people staying in the hotels, to allow like the NFU and farmers to employ them as fruit pickers. Because a lot of British people and English people don't want to work on farms. It's hard work. You need to work all day on your knees and things like that. But it would give people and migrants an opportunity to work while they're waiting for their asylum claims to be put through. And then I think that would show that you and the Labour Party are listening and sort of would help the problems that you have with farmers as well and de-escalate tensions, because it is a difficult position you're in. But I think you just need to make the positive case a little bit more, and especially with the current leader that you have.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I think a lot of people look at it and think, why are they not? Why do we have to support them? And they themselves say, why are you having to support us? Why can't we work? We want to be able to work. It is difficult, though, because you know people don't want to have their jobs taken from them. But there are lots of areas, as you say, where British people are not wanting to take those jobs. I'm afraid, you know, you're talking about farming, and there's lots of others, like social care, and there's lots of areas where we just don't seem to have enough people working in there. And if people were waiting for their asylum claims to be decided on, could get work somewhere else, it would benefit everybody, in my view. Thank you very much for ringing, Tyler. It's really nice to hear from you. And we're getting lots of calls coming in already on this. You can call me on 0345 60 60 94 973. I have to say, I do think the Conservatives would dispute comparisons with the Nazis, and I think there is a special place in hell for the Nazis, as Ray and Whitstable said earlier. But I know there are very strong feelings being expressed on this issue. So the question is this: why do lots of people seem to be protesting about outside asylum hotels, and why are they doing it now? You can call me on 0345 60 60 973. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry, standing in for James O'Brien, and the time now is 10:16.
LBC.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Am I on a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6.
T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
All those glasses are a great choice. And now you can pick a free pair from our Boots range.
Free?
That's right.
What, free?
Absolutely. There's hundreds to choose from too.
For free? Does the manager know?
I am the manager.
Oh, in that case, how do these look?
With buy one, get one free at Boots Opticians, everyone can save in style. Book an eye test today and see what's possible. Free Boots pair when you spend £150 on prescription glasses or sunglasses. Offer ends 23rd of September 2025. T's and C's apply.
Emily Thornberry on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Good morning. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry, on LBC. I'm standing in for James O'Brien. And we're talking about asylum hotels. Why are people protesting? Why are they protesting now? What should the government be doing? Is the government doing the right things? Is the government explaining what it's doing properly? Are you buying what Farage is selling? What about the Conservatives? Let's go to Karan, who's in Coventry. Hello, Karan.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for taking my call. I hope you're well.
I am.
Yeah, so I think the issues that we're seeing at the moment in terms of people, you know, protesting outside asylum hotels, I think it's being lost in why I think it's happening, and I'll explain why. So I think at the moment the UK is obviously facing a lot of problems in a lot of different areas. You know, the NHS is something that is struggling. You know, it's under-resourced, it's understaffed. as we can see by things like ongoing industrial action as well by doctors and nurses, you know, young people struggling to get on the property ladder because of, you know, extortionately high mortgage interest rates. And, you know, even people that are graduating from university struggling to get into work. So I think people are just a little bit, you know, disenfranchised by all of the issues. And I think this is probably a distraction from why this might be happening. Because generally, I think there's not a country in the world that is more accepting of people from different backgrounds than is the UK. The UK is an amazing country. You know, it's very, very, you know, tolerant towards people from all different backgrounds. And I can say that really proudly. You know, my parents have brought me up here. I was born in the UK, you know, but we are of Indian origin. And, you know, we've never faced any level of discrimination or anything of that sort. And I think the race riots that happened last summer, they're not really reflective at all because, you know, in every society, you'll get certain individuals that are just doing these, you know, atrocious things. And I don't think that that is a fair reflection of how, you know, amazing the UK is towards people of all different backgrounds.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I'm really proud of our country because it is so mixed. And it makes us a better country, you know, because we have lots of different people and we and the mixing, you know, is in itself creative and makes us, you know, pushes us and our economy does better and we learn from each other and we have much better creative industries and the just the stimulation of having people from all sorts of backgrounds is definitely a positive. And I'm proud to represent a constituency where, you know, we have dozens and dozens of languages spoken in my constituency, people from all over the world living in Islington, all on top of each other, and we get on. And we're an example to the world. But look, you know, we mustn't be complacent about it. You know, there is clearly tension at the moment as a result of what's going on. And I hear what you say, that it's, that for many people it's a distraction and it's because they feel disempowered. But what do we do about it? I mean, what should the government be doing?
I think the government needs to look to address some of the issues that exist at the moment. So, for example, the NHS is a big talking point when we come to any conversation around, you know, net migration, because obviously it's a resource that is available to people that's in the UK. So I think the government needs to look into addressing those issues because, you know, things like industrial action, etc., those things are going to continue to go on until the government actually look and think, we've got a little bit of a problem here. How can we look to make those changes?
So you mean that when there's a time of scarce resources, particularly public services, the idea of more people coming into the country and maybe competing for those public services is something which worries people? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so even in my profession, so I'm actually a doctor, you know, for resident doctors, it's extremely difficult because you are struggling to get into sort of postgraduate training programs. You know, the number of GP training programs, core psychiatry training programs, areas where we really, really do need doctors and specialists, they're sort of capped.
It's mad, isn't it? It's completely mad. I know we have shortages and yet we can't train enough doctors, even though there are people wanting to do it, to fill the very vacancies that we have. I mean, I know that Wes Streeting's aware of this and we just have to do something about it. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, you've got really talented, able people that want to do these positions, but, you know, the number of places just hasn't kept up with the number of doctors that, you know, want to do those jobs. But that really just comes down to the government not really looking at the fact that, okay, we need to do something. Maybe we do need to increase the number of training places. Maybe we do need to expand the budget when it comes to the NHS. I know that obviously these things can't happen overnight, but I think if the public are able to see meaningful progress or ideas brought to the table, then they might start to have a little bit more belief and confidence.
I think the other thing as well is that I think we need to say more often, Karen, that if it wasn't for migrants and their children, the NHS would have fallen over a long time ago, eh? Because the number of people who work in it, you know, from migrant backgrounds.
Yeah, I think, you know, the UK obviously has long relied on people from all different backgrounds. And I think it's, as you said, something that should be celebrated. You know, diversity in any workplace is always a good thing. I think really people are just very, you know, concerned with some of the issues that exist, you know, the cost of living, you know, young people even struggling to get on the property ladder at the moment. And, you know, when you work hard and you're not able to sort of achieve or meet those basic things that you think to yourself, oh, you know, by now I should probably be a homeowner, or, you know, I should be able to get a doctor's appointment. That's when people then start to get a little bit concerned, and then, you know, the conversation sort of starts to steer in other areas, such as migration.
Yeah. All right. Look, thank you ever so much for ringing, and thank you for your thoughtful contribution, Karen. And good luck. I hope you get your training contract. Let's go to Jane in the Wirral. Hello, Jane.
Hi, Emily. I'm going to say something that's going to sound harsh, but then I'll backtrack on it.
Go on.
I'll give you a bit of background. So I think the problem is the nation has been radicalised for years, absolutely years. There's no way that you'd speak to what people who consider themselves as not racist and not right-wing, but use loaded, weaponised language like undocumented, fighting age, illegal, that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And the reason I phoned in is the day after the general election, having been up for God knows how long, I was getting up to 40 hours by the time I phoned in, and I was very otherworldly.
Mm.
But James said, why isn't everybody celebrating?
Mm.
And I told him then, the reason I'm not celebrating is Labour could have got in with anything in the last general election. You could have said anything and you'd have got in. And you didn't make the case for immigration.
Mm.
And I think, so whereas I don't blame you for the radicalisation, I blame you for not starting the process of de-radicalising people.
Well, some of us do. I mean, as I say, you know, I'm proud to represent the constituency that I represent, and we wouldn't be who we are without migration in Islington and in London. And, you know, London does very well economically, and one of the reasons for that is because we, you know, we've got people from all backgrounds and people with ambition who work hard and who are tolerant and get on with each other and learn from each other. I mean, this is the essence of a successful society.
So why aren't you doing things like saying, because you're in power now, why aren't you doing things like saying, well, why don't we totally take the business model out of the people traffickers by making safe and legal routes for asylum seekers? Because that would immediately take the bottom. There would be no need for small boats. So rather than try and be harsh on, you know, smash the small boats, you could actually just remove the business model by making safe and legal routes.
So I think you have to have a migration system that works, and that has to be one which is fair and fast and firm. You know, when you say no, you mean no. But you have to have a system that works so that people can get into the country in a fair way. And also decisions need to be made quickly, you know, one way or the other. But I think that what's been agreed with France, you know, this one in, one out that everyone has been so critical of, is actually the beginnings of what you're saying when it comes to, you know, getting yourself some proper routes into the country. So, you know, the new deal with France is we're going to send back people who are taking the mickey. And in exchange, we will take people who already have some roots in this country, who might have, you know, an auntie who's already here from Syria or, you know, whatever it is, and who's able to claim asylum and a place that way, so that we can bring people in who we really ought to be, and it is the best place for them to be, is to come over to the UK, rejoin their family and claim asylum in the UK. So there are, you know, the beginnings of legal routes for some countries. We do have some, obviously. We've got safe and legal routes for people from Ukraine and Hong Kong. But I hear what you're saying, that, you know, if you're from Sudan, how do you get to the UK in a legal way? At the moment, there isn't a legal route.
Precisely. So you're pushing at an open door here. I agree with you. But it's still the language. The language is all we're being tough on. We're being tough on these people. You're still, as a government, using the word illegal when actually it's technically irregular people arriving here.
Mm. No, I understand you. But I think also you need to be able to be heard by the public. So you have to meet people halfway. And you have to be able to say, you know, we will be tough. I mean, if someone is coming here taking advantage of a system that we have where we want to be able to give asylum to those who are suffering, you know, within their home countries, who are fleeing from war and torture, and we appreciate that we have an obligation to give them somewhere safe, and there are those who take the mickey and who claim that that's what they are, but they're not, you know, and they're undermining our system. We have to be tough on them, because otherwise the whole system collapses. You need to have a system that people believe in, which means you do need to be tough on those who, as I say, just take the mic.
Yeah, I mean, again, you're pushing us an open door here. I agree completely. I mean, you know, in the past, you could have wandered into, if you were in Sudan or Eritrea, you could have wandered into, if you could have gotten to a British embassy, claimed asylum, be processed overseas, and then bring your family over safely and legally, rather than have to, you know, send your youngest man who's capable of clinging to the bottom of a truck through Syria on a boat across the channel, hope he can get in, hope he can claim asylum, then hope he can reunite his family. It's just so wrong. And we need to start. We need to start de-radicalising people. Again, I phoned James.
I hear you, Jane.
I phoned James about 3 weeks ago. I've got an asylum hotel. I've just worked it out. 246 metres from my house that I've spent. Well, we've actually stopped. We had to count. I mean, I've had death threats. It's not been nice. And
why have you had death threats?
Because I stood in front of a bunch of screaming right wingers.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. And suggested they might like to be quiet. Mm. Sorry, I'm tearing up slightly.
And
we stopped doing a counter demonstration because it was just irritating the locals and scaring the people inside.
Well,
but we've got to do something. So yeah, and James said, "What are you going to do?" And at the time, I didn't know. But what we have actually done, we had a meeting last Thursday. We had about 30 local people, all the local faith groups. Local business, and we formed something called Hoylake for All. That's where I'm from,
right.
And we're starting to do the process of just like trying to build some unity in what's left of the community.
Hang on, Jane. Don't say things like that. You know, it is not right. What's left of the community? I mean, there is. You know, it's going through a period of stress. It sounds like, but I don't believe that your community is dead. I don't believe that for a minute. And it sounds like, you know, you play a really important part in that. And the response of your community is important. I mean, really important. Because you know, sometimes the people who shout loudest seem to be the people who, you know, who get all the attention. Whereas actually there's a lot of people who don't agree with it, but who don't want to go out and make a fuss, but who just look the other way and just go, oh, this is too awful. Let's go to the news. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. More of your calls on the way. If you want to get involved in the conversation, you can call me on 0345 6060 973 or WhatsApp me on the same number. The news headlines at 10:31 with Thomas Watts.
The Lib Dems have accused the maker of the weight loss jab Mounjaro of price gouging in the UK. They are calling for an investigation after LBC revealed a freeze in supply ahead of a steep price hike next week. A typical household will see its energy bill rise by about £3 a month this winter. The energy regulator Ofgem has announced a 2% increase in its price cap from the start of October. A senior minister says closer alignment with EU rules is a necessary step to boost economic growth. Nick Thomas Simmons has insisted the future relationship with Brussels must be based on mutual benefit. LBC weather. Many places seeing a mixture of sunshine and showers, a high of 24 Celsius.
This is LBC.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity, we actually reward you for it. That's why, when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
Searching for a holiday? Here's an idea. Don't type cheap flights to wherever into your browser. You know you do it. Search Kayak instead. Let us do the finding for you. All the great flight deals from hundreds of travel sites, all in one place. Go on, do it. Do it. Listen to the waves. They're calling your name. Not literally, obviously, unless your name is Kayak. Kayak! You're thinking about it, aren't you? Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
It's Munich, 1936, and all eyes are on the capital for the upcoming Olympic Games. As athletes fight for gold and the Nazis fight for power, Detective Sebastian Wolf faces a battle of his own. In a search that will take him from high society to the city's darkest corners, Wolf is about to learn just how easily the hunter becomes the hunted. Evil in High Places is the gripping new historical thriller from the million-copy bestseller Rory Clements. Out now in hardback, ebook, and in audio.
With UK Export Finance, I'm fulfilling more export orders from around the world with working capital support.
Export insurance means I'll get paid when exporting to challenging markets.
At UK Export Finance, we believe no viable UK export should fail for lack of finance or insurance. Between 2023 and 2024, we provided £8.8 billion of government-backed trade finance to support UK exports. Learn how we could help you win export contracts, fulfil orders, and get paid. Search UK Export Finance today.
This is LBC with Emily Thornberry. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Yeah, hello, you're listening to me, Emily Thornberry, on LBC. Do get involved in our conversation. We're talking about asylum hotels. Why are there the demonstrations? What do you think about it? Is the government doing the right things? Should it be doing more? You can either ring us up on 0345 6060 973, or you can WhatsApp us on the same number, or you can text on 84850. I'm going to read out some of the WhatsApp messages and some of the texts. I've got one from Brennan, and he says, Emily, most people I know are all working, but we're all poor. We're all struggling, and it just seems bills and rents are increasing more than our wages. My bills used to be 30% of my salary, but it's more like 75% now. So I think everyone is just tired and see these people as getting freebies. We've been discussing that and discussing whether or not people who are claiming asylum ought to be able to work. At the moment, of course, they're not able to until their status is decided. Once they have got asylum in the country, then they can work. Or if it's decided that they can't, then they are supposed to be sent back. And part of the problem has been that decisions just simply weren't being made under the last government. And there is every effort, I think, by this government to try to catch up on the backlog. I think they've made 31,000 decisions every quarter. But, you know, the faster they make the decisions, obviously more people are coming in. It's very challenging. I've got another one from Isabel from Perth, who says, sorry, but I think that the current person who is speaking to Emily, that's Ray in Whitstable, he was the first person who rang up, is part of the problem. How dare he call people wanting rid of undocumented men right-wing scum? It is ordinary folk who are fed up with being treated as second-class citizens. That's Isabel from Perth. I mean, do ring in as well, Isabel, if you want to come and discuss this. And I've also got David here. David says, hotels are going down, but HMOs are going up. And whilst the number of hotels have gone down, the number of people in hotels have gone up. And let's not forget, we are now having record numbers of people coming over in boats. So they haven't stopped or lowered it at all. Are you really going to allow this guy to use the word scum on live radio? Yeah, well, I think that, I hear what you're saying, David. I mean, I think that the question really is can we turn round a problem like this in a year? Or is it right to give the government a little bit more time and to look at what it is that the government is doing? I mean, have you, David, or have other people actually heard the things which the government are doing? Is the government doing well enough in terms of explaining what it is that people that they're doing? I mean, do people know that there are international intelligence agreements with India, Bulgaria and Romania? I mean, to be honest with you, I didn't know until I looked it up yesterday. But that is, they're looking up and they're working with these countries to try to smash the gangs and to focus in on the gangs. Do we know that in Vietnam there's a campaign going to try to explain to the Vietnamese that if anybody tells you that you just give, you know, a gang a particular amount of money, you will get to the UK, explaining that they're likely to end up working in almost slave conditions on farms or in factories. But let's go back to the calls. I want to go to speak to Rajiv, who's in Twickenham. Hello.
Hi, Emily. Hi. I was saying to your researcher just now that I think... I think the riots and the protests that have gone on since Labour got into office are twofold. Partly because Nigel Farage is very good at speaking to people of that mindset, also Keir Starmer is terrible at it, and he's made a lot of mistakes since getting in. And Labour generally, and I'm going to be perfectly frank with what I'm going to say, because I think mistakes have been made. When you say about, for example, use of hotels are going down, but as somebody else on messages pointed out, people arriving illegally has gone up is going up exponentially, it feels like. So if you're not putting them in hotels, but they're still coming to the UK, where are you going to put them? You're still going to have that problem, and it might be HMOs, it might be private housing. That doesn't solve the problem.
I think the decisions, I think there's a backlog as well. So I think that the government's working really hard at trying to clear the backlog where there were, I mean, honestly, there were literally, you know, I mean, I had it myself. I had people come to my surgeries and just saying, I want to have a decision made. They're not making a decision. And the last government just stopped making asylum decisions. And that was part of the problem. So that was also part. So there's lots of things that the government needs to do. They need to clear the backlog. They need to make sure that the decisions are made faster. They need to enforce those decisions so that if people are not allowed to be here, they need to be returned. And that needs to be, they need to work on that. And they need to also try to discourage people from trying to come over to this country to claim asylum if they really aren't asylum seekers. As I say, like I was saying about the campaign that they're having in Vietnam to try to make sure that the Vietnamese understand that they're not going to be able to come and start a new life in the UK, which will be anything other than exploitation and misery.
I just think you're missing the point there. I don't think whether they're in Vietnam or they're in Syria or in Afghanistan, I'm sure that they're aware of people's sort of reluctance to welcome them to this country, but they'll come anyway unless there is a severe deterrent that is shown that can work. And, you know, whatever you want to say about the previous government, I mean, there was a lot of the prime ministers, but the last one at least was trying to implement something that would be a deterrent, whether, you know, it was being challenged in courts or not. The point is, the people are coming here, they know if there's no deterrent, they'll try their luck.
But hang on. I mean, like, let's look at what happened. I mean, they introduced the Illegal Migration Act, right? And they said anybody coming into the UK on a small boat is going to be an illegal, and they won't be allowed to have asylum, and we won't even discuss their case. And they built up 26,000 people because people didn't stop coming; they kept coming, and they couldn't send them all to Rwanda, even if Rwanda had been decided to be legal. There wasn't enough space in Rwanda for them to be able to send all. Their policy was never big enough to be able to send everyone to Rwanda. That was never going to work. So they just didn't have policies that were fit for purpose, and they knew it. And what gets my goat is hearing, you know, being lectured by the likes of Robert Jenrick, who was one of the guys who negotiated the hotel contracts in the first place, you know, telling the current government that they're doing it all wrong.
I think the principle of Rwanda would have been a deterrent. So the idea is that you some people would be sent, and therefore that has a knock-on effect on the model where people start worrying about whether they would get sent to Rwanda or not. And there was a notable drop in arrivals when Rwanda was first being implemented, if you remember. But when it started getting challenged in courts and flights start getting stopped, that's when the numbers started going back up again.
I think we might be rewriting history a bit. Let me just ask you this, though. Are you buying what Farage is selling? I mean, what do you think about what he says? Because he's saying kind of the same sort of thing. He's saying, you know, he's going to deport everybody, that if anybody comes over in a small boat, that's it. They're all being sent back, including women and children. I mean, do you think that's a good starting point?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, but the problem is it's seductive language now because, I mean, look, if you look at the optics, and rightly or wrongly, in this country now, this has become a real issue for a lot of people in the UK because they're seeing a lot of single men hanging around hotels, usually from Africa or the Middle East, not generally other areas, with no kids or women around them, often because those are men-only hotels, and that's just a cultural thing of those people who come here. They can't be in a hotel with women and children.
Hang on, what? What? Well, these are single men who can't be trusted with women and children.
Why do they have hotels for only for men?
I think it's probably because there's more men coming over on their own than women and children. I mean, I think that's a fact.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because I mentioned to the researcher that there was a Labour MP that suggested the opposite once on television. And again, that's another matter that people look at and suggest that why are Labour not telling us the facts when there actually are huge amounts of single men coming over from those areas, from countries that, A, culturally have issues, have wars as well, and it will make them more difficult to integrate into this country for those backgrounds.
Well, we have always offered sanctuary to people who've come from war zones and people who have been the victims of torture. And of course, it's difficult for them because they've come halfway across the world and they come with the trauma that they've suffered. But, you know, what are you to do? We're human beings. They're human beings. We have a duty to help, don't we?
Absolutely, we do. I mean, and like I say, I come from a background of immigrants that arrived at, in this country from a, you know, from the Commonwealth. So there may be some connection with Commonwealth countries that have similarities with Britain. Yes. However, those, the Fine family and others that came followed a legal process. And it feels you feel cheated when people jump the queue. In many ways, when they are not necessarily, you know, coming legitimately through, you know, an asylum reason.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's fair enough. I mean, I absolutely, and it's well put, that point, Rajiv. And I think that's the point about having an immigration and asylum system that works. You know, people have to have confidence in it. They have to know that if you are given asylum in this country, it is because you have suffered, you know, because you have come from a war zone, because you have been raped, because you have been tortured. You need to have sanctuary, and we're offering sanctuary. And that's why it's really important that we process people quickly, that we're firm about decisions that we make, and that we return people. And that is what the government needs to be doing. But they are doing it from a standing start, Rajiv. I mean, that's the point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, the system inherited was bad,
yeah.
You know, and I will say that towards the end of the Tory government, they were trying to make moves to getting things right, but it was probably too little too late by that stage. And now, you know, Labour have got a lot on their hands, not just with this, but with the economy, with taxation. What are the right choices to make? What are the wrong choices?
And I think, you know, people looking around the other British citizens, if they see people, you know, of different colour or whatever, who kind of clearly come from a background where, you know, there has been migration in the family, everyone needs to be confident that people are here legally, and they're here for the right reasons. And that if you have an asylum system or an immigration system that breaks down, then it isn't just the recent migrants who are affected, it's also people who have been here for many generations, because it'll simply feed prejudice against them. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. As somebody from that background, I agree. Mm. But I've never experienced that level. You know, there's always been racism in this country. But it feels like this is another level of racism that's being created, because people will be suspicious of whether you came here legally or not, or whether you gamed the system.
No, I understand. I understand what you're saying. And the worry is real. Thank you ever so much for ringing. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry, on LBC. I'm standing in for James O'Brien. There are more of your calls on the way. We're talking about why this year the topic of asylum hotels is such a live one. You can join in by calling on 03456060973. And the time now is 10:46.
LBC.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet. Ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Tough. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
It's Munich, 1936, and all eyes are on the capital for the upcoming Olympic Games. As athletes fight for gold and the Nazis fight for power, Detective Sebastian Wolf faces a battle of his own. In a search that will take him from high society to the city's darkest corners, Wolf is about to learn just how easily the hunter becomes the hunted. Evil in High Places is the gripping new historical thriller from the million-copy bestseller Rory Clements. Out now in hardback, ebook, and in audio.
With UK Export Finance, I'm fulfilling more export orders from around the world with working capital support.
Export insurance means I'll get paid when exporting to challenging markets.
At UK Export Finance, we believe no viable UK export should fail for lack of finance or insurance. Between 2023 and 2024, we provided £8.8 billion of government-backed trade finance to support UK exports. Learn how we could help you win export contracts, fulfil orders, and get paid. Search UK Export Finance today.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity. We actually reward you for it. That's why, when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
The Virgin Atlantic Holiday Sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai
and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
Emily Thornberry on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Good morning. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry on LBC. I'm standing in for James O'Brien. I've got time for a few more calls on the asylum hotels topic. We've got about 10 minutes and then we're moving on to something else. But we've had many, many calls. Let me see if I can rattle through a few. So, Nigel, you're in Uxbridge. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Firstly, I want to talk about the deterrent. We talk about this all the time, creating a deterrent. And I think that these people are already risking death to come here by getting on a dinghy boat to get to the UK. That is the ultimate deterrent. So nothing else is going to deter these people. They are that desperate. So, you know, this talk of creating a deterrent, it's not going to work. They're already, the ultimate deterrent is already death.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and another thing, I don't think we talk enough about Britain's role in creating the conditions for migration. I mean, it's never really acknowledged. I mean, foreign policy blunders, we have had endless wars and decades of, you could talk about colonial extraction. No one talks about or educate people enough on Britain's foreign policy that creates the root causes of these issues is created a lot by our foreign policy. We've had endless wars, Iraq, Afghanistan. What's going on in Palestine right now is going to create even more refugees. So, I mean, people need to be educated, and I think politicians are doing a poor job. The likes of Keir Starmer are doing a poor job of explaining this to people and getting people to understand what the root causes are. You know,
but tell me, I mean, I hear you, but tell me this. Right, let's say, for example, we were responsible for what's going on in Sudan. I mean, we're not, but, you know, we do have a history in Sudan as a country.
Yeah.
Does that then mean that everybody in Sudan should move to the UK? I mean, clearly not.
No, absolutely not. I'm not saying everybody. That's not possible. I mean, we have to share the love, right? Europe has to share the love. We're in this together. I mean, we don't take anywhere near as much as a lot of countries do anyway.
Mm.
I think we're one of the lowest anyway. When you look at the numbers, when you compare us to Germany and the likes, and if we have to share love. I'm not saying Britain should take everyone, but we have a responsibility.
I mean, we're basically at the end of a long road, aren't we? So if you were, from Sudan, you would, and you needed to run, you'd run to the neighbouring country, and most people do that. And then some go further afield, and some go further afield. And then then if you're Sudanese, then coming to the UK is a very long route. I mean, to finally come to the UK, there are many other countries en route.
No, absolutely. But then we forget. I mentioned Britain's colonial past. I mean, a lot of people speak English. They want to come to a country that speaks the same language as well. That's another thing that's not often discussed. You know, so there's a lot that people need to be educated on. And I want to mention this as well. Immigration has always been a net benefit to the UK, economically, socially, and culturally, I would argue as well. And migrants are often overrepresented in industries like the NHS, logistics, hospitality. And without them, the system collapsed. Again, we need to talk about these things. I don't feel it ever gets mentioned, you know, and it's frustrating to me.
Well, you've mentioned it this morning, Nigel, and you've mentioned it well. Thank you very much. Thank you for ringing. Can I move over to Andrew from Lanark in Scotland? Hello, Andrew.
Dame Emily, I never spoke to Dame before. It's very exciting. Nice to speak to you.
Well, we don't just come out of panto time.
Right, okay, very good. the first part, I'm going to, just the background is, you probably won't like it. I'm a lost Labour voter, I'm afraid to say.
Okay.
Mr Blair was the last time I voted for a Labour government.
What have you been doing instead then?
Voting for Conservatives, I'm ashamed to say now, after that last fiasco. Yeah. But you know what my problem is?
Mm.
I think we should give Labour, as much as I'm unhappy with the present Labour government, for lots of reasons, they have to be given more time.
They have to be given a chance, don't they? They have to be given a chance.
You can't, these things don't happen overnight. And, and unfortunately, the biggest mistake I think they're making at the moment is bad communication. Farage, oh my God, the guy makes my skin crawl, but he's communicating to the people in a way that they they're hearing him. And then
we have to challenge him. I mean, we have to challenge
absolutely,
him.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, his plan, right? I mean, it does not make sense. He says he's going to deport everybody. Well, where's he going to deport everybody to? And he's going to pay countries to take people. I mean, like, what are you going to do? So he's going to pay dictators to take people. What's he going to do in Sudan? Is he going to send young girls back to Sudan in order to be raped?
He's a fool.
Or like paying people to take them. I mean, it's outrageous. It really is outrageous.
Do you know why he's like that? And this is the whole problem. There's lots of problems going on in this country at the moment. I'm not going to list them. We all know what they are. The health service, blah, blah, blah. The problem and the reason that there will always be problems, there'll always be issues, there'll always be injustices, there'll always be laws that need change and amending, whatever. It all comes from your old place of work, the House of Commons. That's the problem, and I'll tell you why. The problem is now we need politicians who are parliamentarians, who are in politics for public service, for beliefs. They want to be a socialist, a capitalist, a liberal, a protester, whatever it is. I'm talking about proper parlamentarians. You were one.
I still am, mate. Where do you think gone? It's because I've become a dame. It doesn't mean I'm not in Parliament anymore.
You're a parliamentarian. You sit on committees. You push agendas. Housing was one of yours, I think, and rights for women. You're a bit of an environmentalist, if I remember.
That's right.
You know, so you had issues that you felt passionately about, and you wanted to support them, and you took them forward. Parliamentarians like Tony Benn, like Theresa May, like Clark, whether you agreed with their politics or not, they were parliamentarians, and they made decisions, sometimes wrong, sometimes right, but they made decisions. They got things moving. And currently, at the moment, Farage is not a parliamentarian. He's no more a parliamentarian than I am.
No.
And then you get
never see him. He's never there.
Exactly.
He might turn up occasionally to Prime Minister's questions, but otherwise we never see him. He doesn't do any parliamentary work at all.
It's a career. Like the previous three or four Tory prime. I've lost count of how many Tory prime ministers we have. The career people, they're in it for the career. They need to give the Labour government a chance. And the danger is, because of the way that it's being miscommunicated or not communicated, is, a lot of these people that are demonstrating are just numpties. They don't know anything about what they're shouting about. They're just out because it's a good idea to give the police a kick in. I've been there. I was a police officer. So I know exactly what their motivation is, because you hear them talking in the ranks, right, there's only so many, let's go, all that kind of stuff. But
I don't think everybody's like that, though. I mean, I do think that there have been other people who've been swept up in this, and
that's
who do
what I was
think.
Just about to
yeah.
say,
sorry,
that's
sorry, Andrew.
The dangerous bit. That's the dangerous bit. Normal working people. Somebody regarded to them. One of your last callers said, ordinary folk. The ordinary people are being dragged into it. They're getting carried away with it. They're not being informed properly. By the people who should be informing them, and that's the government. And then you've got these other people who are the worst of the lot, generic, who has created more problems than he's ever solved in his short life. And now he's piping up and waving flags. It's laughable.
I think what's the biggest lot, I think what's terrible is that, you know, this is Farage's big issue, right? This is the big thing for him. And yet, when he finally announces his policy, it's 6 pages. Two of them are the front page and the back page. That's 4 pages. The money doesn't add up. It's supposed to only cost £10 billion over 5 years. And yet Rupert Lowe, his sidekick, had exactly the same policy, and it was 47.5. And when people ask what's the difference, he goes and says, oh, it's because Zia Yusuf is good at maths. I mean, I never knew that maths could actually do that. And it is a different type of maths to the maths I understand.
It's buzzwords. It's all these buzzwords that they're using, and it's headlines. It's the and you asked earlier on. You said, right, who's to blame? Is it the media? Is it people like Farage? Is it the government? What the Tories didn't do when they should have done, and they were despicable what they did. They saw the writing on the wall. They knew they were going to get booted out, so they just kicked that can down the road a bit, waiting for you guys to come in. And now everybody wants to know, you've been here 5 minutes, what are you doing about it?
Listen, Andrew, we could talk all morning, but I've got to go because I've got to get to the news, and we're going to talk next about Ukraine. Thank you for ringing, though. We had a really interesting conversation, and I think that we've had all points of view. I think people have blamed the Labour, they've blamed the Tories, they've blamed Farage, they've blamed politicians generally. They've talked about how the system isn't working properly. They've talked about the importance of an asylum and immigration system that does work, not just for most people in the country, but particularly for those whose families do come from a migrant background, because we all need to be confident that those who are living here are here legally and properly and have a place and have a right to be here. So I think that, you know, it's a really important conversation. Thank you very much, everybody, for your calls. We're going to talk next about Trump and Ukraine. Is he going to do anything? What is the future for Ukraine? What should Britain be doing? How are we going to ensure that finally there's peace in Ukraine? So the question's this. Do you trust Donald Trump to secure peace for Ukraine? You're listening to LBC. My name's Emily Thornberry. I'm sitting in for James O'Brien. And the time now is just coming up to 11 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the maker of the weight loss jab Mounjaro has been accused of price gouging in the UK. The Lib Dems are calling for an investigation after LBC revealed a freeze in supply of the drug ahead of a steep price hike next week. Eli Lilly is raising the cost of Mounjaro by up to 170%. Thorin Govind, chair of the Royal Pharmaceutical Society, says it's being driven by the White House.
Donald Trump has been pushing for homegrown manufacturers in the US, the pricing, to decrease in the US. And that has meant that Eli Lilly is trying to get their pricing in line with Europe, but is also part of how much drugs may end up costing us here in the UK. So we're expecting this might not be the only drug that goes up in price.
Eli Lilly says it manages the supply of medicines in line with legal protections to prevent stockpiling. The Cabinet Office Minister, Nick Thomas-Simmons, says he is prepared for a political fight over the UK's relationship with the EU. His confirmed talks with Brussels on a permanent food and drink deal will begin this autumn. Mr. Thomas-Simmons says it'll deliver practical benefits rather than easy answers and snake oil offered by his political opponent. Households across Britain are facing another energy bill increase from the start of October. The energy regulator Ofgem has raised its price cap by 2%, or about £3 a month for a typical gas and electricity bill. The hike reflects a rise in network costs and covering discounts for lower income households. Tim Jarvis from Ofgem says households should consider moving to a new tariff.
There's around a third of households are on fixed rate deals, so they won't be affected by today's cap. And I would very much urge people who aren't on a fixed rate deal to look at the market, see what's available. We know there are deals on the market that are around £200 a year less.
President Trump's expected to chair a meeting on Gaza at the White House later. Israel's Foreign Minister Gideon Saar is set to hold separate talks with his US counterpart Marco Rubio. A doubled 50% tariff on Indian goods imported to the US has come into effect. The additional penalty was announced earlier this month in response to India's continued use of Russian oil. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 92.75. That is up 10 points. The pound buys $1.34 and the euro 15. LBC weather. Many places seeing a mixture of sunshine and showers. A band of heavier rain moving northeastwards across the UK. A high of 24 Celsius. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Emily Thornberry.
Good morning, you're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. I'm standing in for James O'Brien on LBC until 1 o'clock today. I want to talk about one of the biggest issues internationally, something which has been rattling on for years and years, and it's difficult to know where it's going, and that's the issue of Ukraine. Now, we know that Donald Trump has said that he would fix the issue of Ukraine. He'd bring peace to Ukraine within the first 24 hours. Now, obviously, he's not done that. And he seems to be trying. He seems to think that he can do something. He's been having meetings with Putin, and he's been sending his envoy backwards and forwards. Steve Witkoff had many meetings in Moscow, and as far as I understand it, recently came back with the message that the Russians were ready for peace, which Trump believed, and went off and had his conversation with Putin and his press conference afterwards, which was then followed up by European leaders scuttling across the Atlantic to have a big meeting with Donald Trump to try to ensure that that the deal was one that actually looked after the interests of Ukraine. It's very difficult, though, to know what it is that's in Donald Trump's head and what peace would look like with Donald Trump. We all remember, don't we, that shocking time in the White House where Donald Trump, as newly elected president, had his first meeting with the president of Ukraine, where he berated him, where he bullied him, where it was really a distressing scene. And you just thought, well, how are we ever going to get a peace for Ukraine that's going to be fair and just if this is Donald Trump's attitude? And more importantly, perhaps even the deputy, the vice president's attitude to Ukraine was very worrying indeed. We seem to have pulled back from that. And I have to say, I think that Britain played a blinder on it. Keir Starmer played a blinder with his advisers and managed to persuade Donald Trump that actually wasn't the way. The peace in Ukraine did not mean that the Ukrainians had to essentially give up and put up the white flag and let the Russians take over. That was not the way to get peace, and that we had to stand up to Russia. But there is vacillation, and it does seem as though you get the meeting with the European leaders and Donald Trump seems to appreciate that it's important to stand up to Russia, that this is not a matter of land swaps because Ukraine hasn't got any land to swap. It is Ukraine. And Russia is certainly not going to give Ukraine any land. Indeed, Russia wants to have land that it hasn't even managed to conquer yet after all of these years of war. They still want to get the whole of the Donbass because they've been fighting over it and not been able to get it. They've only been able to get some of it, and they seem to believe that this should be part of a peace process. Is Putin getting the better of Trump? What can we do to ensure? Because it's in our interests to ensure that the Ukrainians succeed. Ukraine needs to win this war. They are fighting this war on behalf of all of us. If the Russians think that they can just walk into a neighboring country, they're not going to stop with Ukraine. And in the meantime, it has deeply affected all of us because you look at the prices of your energy bills are all going up. That is a direct result of the war in Ukraine and the disruption that's happening. So we need to find a peace which is fair and equitable. But what do you think? What does fair and equitable look like? What should we be doing? Should we even be doing anything? Are you bored of this? Do you think we should just walk away now? Do you think that Keir Starmer is right when he says that we should be putting together a coalition of the willing? And what does that look like? Does that look like British army are going to be going into Ukraine and fighting the Russians potentially? Or what? Well, we have enough forces if we are also still sending our forces to Estonia, where we do. We have so few members of the armed forces these days. Are we going to have enough to be able to cover Estonia, Ukraine, and anything else that we might need to have the armed forces for? I'd be really interested to know what your view is, because this war has been going on for a long time now, and it's difficult for people to sustain an interest, and we just don't seem to be getting anywhere. So I'm concerned that, I mean, I think in Britain, of all of the European countries, we have the clearest and strongest view when it comes to Russia. And it's not surprising, given that the Russians just walked into our country and have been killing people. We will all remember the poisonings in Salisbury and the way in which Putin just took the mickey when it came to trying to explain it. He put forward his two security agents who were talking about, oh, we were very interested in visiting Salisbury Cathedral. That was just nonsense, and they just laughed at us. So I think there's no way that the British public don't remember that and believe that we should stand up to Putin, and we know the colour of him, we understand what he's like, and we know that we have to stand up to him. But can we sustain it for many more years? And what does support of Ukraine look like? How much should we be doing? Is it right for us to be doing what we're doing? Do we have the energy to sustain the course? Let's hear from Tony. Tony in Fareham. Hello, Tony.
Yeah, good morning, Emily. Hope you're well.
I'm good.
I think Putin is can't afford to stop the war, because if he does, if there is a ceasefire and if there is an end to the fighting, then the people returning from the front line are going to be highly, highly disaffected. Some of them will be hardened, if you like, for want of a better word, by the fighting. And they'll return to a Russia, which is a different country than probably when they left, with no jobs and no future for them, except in the defence industry, which obviously requires highly skilled people. Those people in from the front line, probably, with all respect to them, won't be highly skilled. They'll just be run-of-the-mill people from the population who have been recruited and conscripted. Secondly, the American...
Hang on, before you move on. I mean, just to say, I think you're right, but I think the other thing, the other factor which is important for people to remember, is that a lot of the people who are being sent to the front line come... I mean, Russia is vast, as we know. Yeah, and so they take them from the regions of Russia that are furthest away from Moscow, in some of the poorest areas, where people are being paid essentially blood money. You know, if their young men are sent to the front line and are killed, the family, the village, gets a certain amount of money, and you know, there is a benefit to a poor area if they're getting some form of income, and it's almost as cynical as that, you know, and that's a way of kind of. If everybody was being sent from Moscow, then it would be a different matter. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, those people won't be paid. They'll be put on the shelf, and they won't be paid. They'll just be laid off, for want of a better word. The second point that I was going to raise is that the American military, you've got lots of American military generals like Hodges, Petraeus, Hertling, who come out and say, what are you doing? What is Trump doing? And they need to stand up and be counted now, and they need to be saying to President Trump, you've got to reinforce Europe. You've got to put 5 divisions into Eastern Europe, isolate Kaliningrad, and put up a no-fly zone. It's the only way that you're going to stop Putin.
Just for people who don't know what about Kaliningrad? Do you want to just explain? Because unfortunately, many people don't know.
It's a Russian enclave in Europe, in Eastern Europe, which has got the flatlands there, which is obviously something that in the event of any confrontation would need to be quickly isolated.
I mean, it's like a little island, isn't it? And it's absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's not. It hasn't got a sea around it. It's got land around it, but it's absolutely armed to the teeth. I mean, that's just so people know. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, but my point is that these people negotiating with Putin, Witkoff, he's completely out of his depth. He's a real estate broker. What's he doing in that situation?
You know, he's a friend of Trump's, isn't he? Trump trusts him. He played golf with
him. You know, but the man is clearly, you've only got to watch him and his body language to see that he's completely, completely ill at ease and out of his depth. He's got Hegseth, who's a defense secretary, who... I don't know, it's just that. Well, the words fail me, really.
Well, I mean, just going back to Witkoff, I mean, that's the problem, is that Witkoff had been to Moscow several times and had got the understanding that the Russians wanted peace, but clearly that wasn't true, you know, and he misunderstood.
Absolutely nothing other than Putin's demands, which haven't changed from day one. And we're in the situation now where you've got Europe on one side of the fence and the Americans on the other, the testing point for me was where the Americans voted against the invasion of Ukraine, along with North Korea and people like Brazil and indeed Russia. that just would have made everybody sit up and think, what the hell is going on? What is NATO doing? And my third point, lastly, is that the Americans have got bases all over Europe. They need us. They need us as much as we need them. We need them in Europe for their intelligence drives and their intelligence assets. But those intelligence assets are all linked to Europe. They've got bases all over Europe. You look at what's in this country, our own country, and in the event of any confrontation with China, especially with the access to the Arctic that we've got in Scotland and the Orkneys, they will need us probably more than anything.
Well, I hear what you say. I mean, I just wonder whether I think over the long term, the Americans will be looking to the Pacific more than they will be looking towards Europe. And I think they do expect Europe to be able to look after itself. And obviously the difficulty is that in order for Europe to defend itself, we need to have a lot more unity than we have at the moment when it comes to there are things like if you want to have a new jet, let's say, which costs billions to develop. Which country is going to pay for what? Will we get the French doing one wing and the Spanish doing another and the Germans doing the wheels? I mean, I'm not joking. This is kind of almost the way in which defence procurement has been happening over the years. And in order for Europe to work together, we need to get a new defence industry, which is pan-European, and we need to be able to trust each other. And I'm not sure that we necessarily do. What do you think?
Well, we've already got that with the Eurofighter.
Yeah, exactly. And look how well that's doing.
Yes. I mean, it's probably one of the best fighter aircraft in the world. You know, it is without a doubt. You know, the Americans think it's absolutely wonderful.
Why do we keep buying American stuff then?
because you've only got to look at the strength of their defence industry to see that there has to be a standardisation of American, especially in armour, a standardisation of ammunition across the board, especially with tanks, which until recently our army hasn't had. Mm. So you've got this coming together of forces in Europe, together with the Americans, is the only way to secure the Europe's future against someone like Putin.
Yeah.
And going back to what you were saying about the Arctic, the Chinese and the Russians both have an interest in the Arctic because obviously with the melting ice, the sea lanes are changing. So my view is that in the event of any conflagration with China, America will need us as much as we need America.
Yeah. All right. Look, thank you very much for your call. It's very nice to hear from you, Tony. Thank you. Now, you're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. You can call me on 0345 6060 973. You can WhatsApp me on the same number or text on 84850. The time now is 11:16.
This is LBC.
It's happening. It's real. It's...
Oh,
it's,
not this again. What's happening?
The mini sale event. Financial contributions across the range.
Okay, take a break.
Even John Cooper Works models. And it's on top of all other offers.
Say that again.
There's no time.
The mini sale event. Breathtaking offers 4th to 8th of September at Vines Guildford Mini. Applicable on new mini orders placed during the sale event and registered by 31st of December 2025. Visit mini.co.uk/sale event.
This is your business. This is your business supercharged with the help of Xero Accounting Software. These are your numbers. These are your numbers sorted with the help of Xero Accounting Software. This is you.
Hi.
This is you taking business where you want with the help of Xero Accounting Software.
Hello, world.
This is your business supercharged with the help of Xero and having your numbers sorted all at the same time so you can finally focus on taking business where you want to. Supercharge your business today with the help of Xero.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Emily Thornberry on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Good morning. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. I've got more of your calls on the way. But in the meantime, I'd like to read some of the text messages because we've had a large number of them. Our subject is on Ukraine. What's the future? Can Donald Trump get peace? I've got this from Will. He's saying economic sanctions will now hurt Russia, but Trump will not move against Putin as he's scared of him. Britain could bite the bullet and jump on tax havens hiding Russian gangsters' money, but we're scared of upsetting the king. The king? Anyway, Will, thank you very much. I mean, the truth is that there is a large amount of Russian money, Russian state assets, in Europe and in Britain. And at the moment, we've got it frozen. And I think that it is entirely legal for us to grab that money and to use it, and to use it for the rebuilding of Ukraine and the investment in Ukraine, which I think includes allowing them to develop a defense industry and put investment into that, because they're going to need to keep defending themselves, because even if there is a peace that is agreed, they need to make sure that as soon as we're not looking anymore, that the Russians don't try again. That's my view. I've got a message here, an SMS from Ian in Surbiton. Hi, Emily. If not President Trump, who else can bring a just peace for Ukraine? Who does Putin fear? Strange as it sounds, it might be Xi of China. Well, yes, it's possible, but I don't know if China is really interested at the moment. I think China has also part of the problem is that I think that if Russia is allowed to get away with this, then the Chinese may learn a lesson from that and may be looking avariciously over at Taiwan, which for them is unfinished business, and they still want to bring Taiwan back into China again. The worry is that if the Chinese see that nothing happens, if this is what you do, then it may just encourage them. I've got a message from Josh who says, Ukraine will become... Is it Europopes? Oh, Europe's. Sorry. Europe's new military industrial base. So invest in Ukraine and support them to the max. Well, they certainly are developing a new industry, I mean, their ability to use to make drones on kitchen tables is extraordinary, and warfare has certainly changed since the Ukraine war started, and they are doing phenomenally well. And they, as I say, they are, in my view, they are fighting this war on behalf of all of us. Let's go to Phil. That's Phil's in Oxford. Hello, Phil.
Emily, good morning. How are you? Speak to you. Yeah, before nice I get stuck you. In, can I just say thanks very much for all your great and ongoing parliamentary career. You've always turned up for the good guys, really appreciate it. Anyway, back to some bad guys, so to speak. We have to, as far as I'm concerned, support Ukraine to the hilt. There is obviously a humanitarian imperative, there's a legal imperative, there's a moral imperative. But the biggest thing, or a big thing as well, is if we don't, we will embolden Putin to carry on.
Yeah.
I discussed with Lewis Goodall last week the fact that people don't talk about this, but the Russians are massing forces on the Finnish borders.
Yeah.
They're trying to renegotiate the Gulf of Finland maritime boundaries. So they're being expansionist in other directions already. If Trump believes that he can make a deal with Putin, as he puts it, he's absolutely deranged, because Putin seems to have him exactly where he wants to be, and that's the reality. And I think the European governments, united, have got to stand together and say, we need an alternative. We need a European army. We need the ability to be able to defend ourselves in the probability that the US will be stepping back. And it's as simple as that. Putin wants as much as he can get for a Russian empire. And that's the whole reality.
Don't we effectively have a European army in a way in NATO?
Well, yes, But we do rely, that is so underpinned financially and in terms of ordnance and what have you, by the Americans.
No, I understand that, but can't we develop NATO? Can't we develop NATO away from the dependence on America rather than try and, you know, reinvent the wheel almost?
Sure. Actually, I think it's semantics, really. We need a force that's either coming out of NATO, NATO 2, which is strong for Europe, or we call it a European army. I mean, I prefer to call it a European army because it snubs the thumb at Trump, really, in terms of, well, we don't need NATO anymore. But no, I take the point. I take the point. Whatever it is, we've got to get there, and we've got to get there quickly because Putin is ready to move quickly.
Yeah.
We're in tough times.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thank you for your call, Phil. Can I move to Chris in Waltham Forest, who's Secretary of the Ukraine Solidarity Campaign? Hello, Chris.
Good morning, Emily. Thank you. You can hear me? Sorry.
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
Hi. Yeah.
So what do you think? Do you think there's a chance of peace under Trump or not?
I think the idea that Trump can bring peace sounds very appealing at first hand, but when you look what he's actually proposing, it's not in any way a sustainable peace.
So what is he proposing? Because I get confused. He seems to be saying different things at different times.
Well, sometimes we need to put away the rhetoric of Donald Trump and look what he actually has been doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's put no pressure on Putin whatsoever since he came to office, and all the coercion has been against Ukraine. He has, besides the horrible scenes we saw in the Oval Office, he stopped aid to Ukraine and sharing intelligence, which provided assistance warnings for air attacks,
yes,
which resulted in the death of hundreds of soldiers and hundreds of civilians. He's promised additional sanctions. They gave two deadlines, then none of them happened.
Well, sorry to cut across you, Chris, but hang on. But I'm just thinking, you know, I heard on the radio this morning, didn't I, about Trump was introducing sanctions on India for buying Russian oil?
There's no sanctions on Turkey. There's no sanctions on China. There's only sanctions on India, which seems more related to U.S. trade relations with India than helping Ukraine.
But that's what he's saying. I mean, he is saying they're secondary sanctions and he's trying to stop the Indians buying Russian oil. So I'm just putting that out there.
Well, that was not what was promised. What was promised was severe consequences.
Yes.
This is far, far from that. He stopped all military aid to Ukraine and replaced it with a very grotesque and cynical sales to Europe. And when he previously stopped aid to Ukraine, he certainly didn't restore it in the same quantity, did he? And so far, where's been the pressure on Putin? Where's the concessions from Putin? There's been none. All this seems to be is rapprochement with Putin's Russia in the interests of American foreign policy at the detriment of Ukraine. But what is he proposing, Emily? You've seen it. He's legitimizing an annexation, which was conducted by force at a minimum, and more. He may be looking for pressure in Ukraine to concede further territory.
And explain the territory that he wants. Explain why the Donbass is so important.
The Donbass is very important because it was the industrial base of Ukraine.
Yeah.
Also the coastal areas. But we have to remember, Trump uses the word assets. We need to remember there are people. There are millions of people under the occupied areas, which is a terror regime. We've also had tens of thousands of children kidnapped. None of that will be resolved in a Trump peace plan. All those people will still be occupied. Those children will still be held. And, of course, there'll be no justice for the war crimes, will there?
Yeah.
On it. For the world we live in.
And just on the Donbass, because Putin is saying that, you know, he wants to keep what he has already and the Donbass. And he's been fighting over the Donbass, and the fighting's been going on in the Donbass in particular, and it's particularly fortified, isn't it?
Well, he hasn't taken all of the Donbass, and in fact, contrary to the constant stories we get told about cities will fall, Ukraine is still holding territory in the Donbass, despite being starved of aid, and it's proven that the Russians could be not only stopped, but with sufficient aid, they could be turned back.
Yeah.
So why should we portray it as a situation constantly that Ukraine must surrender its land?
What do you think about the suggestion that the Americans should change their policy and allow the Ukrainians to use the weapons, the American weapons that they have, to fire into Russia?
I think that should be happening far more extensively. But furthermore, now that the Americans are clearly are not on the side of Ukraine and have backed off, we surely the European powers and the UK could take a lead to rally Europe to provide effective alternatives, aid supplies to Ukraine, so they can begin to take steps to end the occupation. We have plans for major rearmament in Europe. A small proportion of that investment could provide effective aid to Ukraine, as well as the economic measures.
You're saying that that the investment in Ukraine, it's investing in Ukraine. If you pay money over to Ukraine so they can defend themselves, they're defending themselves and all of Europe too, and it's a cheap way of doing it.
Well, I wouldn't use the word cheap, Emily, because there are lives involved. But yeah. I'm not talking monetary, I'm talking about the value of human life. But yeah. The whole justification for the programme of rearmament in UK and Europe is the threat of Russia, which is a real threat to Europe. But if we want to tackle the threat of Russia, the front line of that is in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And we're not tackling the threat of Russian aggression if we reward it. And that is what the Trump plan involves, rewarding Russian aggression. And there is an alternative, which could involving economic and military aid, economic sanctions. And you've mentioned seizing the assets. Mm. There's nearly 60% of Russian oil coming through European waters that could be stopped. That's not being addressed. There's the assets in Europe, assets in the UK. There's liquefied gas coming through British ports that hasn't been stopped. And plus there's the military. You know, the United Kingdom only gave Ukraine 14 tanks when we had 79 available. That, to me, shows there was a flaw over these years of just drip-feeding military aid, enough to resist, but never enough to win.
And certainly from the Ukrainians that I've met, their determination to win is just extraordinary, and their bravery is, I'm so impressed with them. I'm so impressed with them. They're a small country fighting back another country, which is how much bigger than them? I mean, just vast. Yet they've been able to hold them off all these years. It's extraordinary.
Nuclear superpower, all these years, why should we break trust with them now when repeatedly politicians promised they would stand with Ukraine until the end?
Yes.
But now we're hearing is we just have to stand with Donald Trump, who frankly is as much of a threat to democracy in many ways than Putin at times.
So you say walk away from Trump and be the sole support of Ukraine?
I don't think it's a question of walk away from Trump. Trump's already walked away from Ukraine and in a large degree Europe. Really, when we begin talking about coalitions of the willing, it should be willing to assist Ukraine. And I think Europe is the only source of the resources for Ukraine to win. Mm. And that's where we need to rally. And I really think it's time for the government to explain to Parliament and the British people why we changed our position when Trump took over, that we were no longer for helping Ukraine win, but we were for providing underpinning and scaffolding to a Trump deal. And I don't think we should be doing that at all. We should be continuing our position properly to assist Ukraine to end the occupation and safeguard peace and freedom in Europe at the same time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you for ringing in and for giving us the benefit of your insight. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. More of your calls on the way about Ukraine and whether you trust Trump to secure peace there. You can call me on 0345 60 60 973, and we're going to the news headlines at 11:31 with Thomas Watts.
The Lib Dems are calling for the competition watchdog to investigate the maker of the weight loss jab Mounjaro. It's after LBC revealed a freeze in supply of the drug to pharmacies ahead of a steep price hike next week. Reform UK has gained its first MSP. Graham Simpson, who represents Central Scotland, has defected from the Scottish Conservatives. The energy regulator Ofgem has confirmed a larger than expected increase in its price cap from October. The rise of 2% will help to cover a discount for low-income households and rising networks. Cost. LBC weather, many places seeing a mixture of sunshine and showers, a high of 24 degrees.
LBC.
With UK Export Finance, I'm fulfilling more export orders from around the world with working capital support.
Export insurance means I'll get paid when exporting to challenging markets.
At UK Export Finance, we believe no viable UK export should fail for lack of finance or insurance. Between 2023 and 2024, we provided £8.8 billion of government-backed trade finance to support UK exports. Learn how we could help you win export contracts, fulfill orders, and get paid. Search UK Export Finance today.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools, and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
It's Munich, 1936, and all eyes are on the capital for the upcoming Olympic Games. As athletes fight for gold and the Nazis fight for power, Detective Sebastian Wolf faces a battle of his own. In a search that will take him from high society to the city's darkest corners, Wolf is about to learn just how easily the hunter becomes the hunted. Evil in High Places is the gripping new historical thriller from the million-copy bestseller Rory Clements. Out now in hardback, ebook, and in audio.
This is LBC with Emily Thornberry. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Good morning. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry, on LBC. I'm talking at the moment, we're talking about Ukraine and what's going to happen next. And can we trust Donald Trump to find peace? What more should we be doing? Are we doing enough? Should we even be continuing to stand with Ukraine? We promised we would. We promised we would stand with Ukraine until they found victory. It's a long time in coming. 3 years. Are you fed up? Do you want us to stop supporting them? Do you think that we should spend the money on something else? Or do you agree with me, which is that Ukraine is fighting a war on behalf of all of us and that we have to stand up to Russia? And if we don't, then they're not going to stop there. And we need to put Putin back in his box. It's really important that we do that, in my view. And also, it has the Ukrainian war has a direct effect on us and on our standard of living. We know that the war in Ukraine has put prices up of food, of energy. So we need to make sure that the war is finished and that there is peace and that there is justice for the people of Ukraine. Do you have Ukrainians living with you? Many of us put Ukrainians up when the war first started. And there are Ukrainians up and down the country still in our economy and playing a really important part. So that's what we're talking about now until 12 o'clock. And after 12 o'clock, we're going to talk about something completely different. Which is going to be about social media and what the social media's impact is on children. Should we be banning social media accounts for under 16s, as the Australians are about to do? What's the impact on you of social media, but more importantly, of your children or children you know? Should we be doing more? Will we be looking back on this in 10 years' time and think, what did we do? There's a whole generation who have not been able to develop properly or fully or have suffered as a result. It's very interesting what Gen Z has to say about it. They're the ones who perhaps have grown up with social media, and they are more critical of social media than any other age group. Anyway, that's at 12 o'clock. But until then, let's go back to Ukraine. Is there something that we could have done differently? Was there more help that we could have given? Could we have intervened at a more pivotal moment? Before the Russians began their full-scale invasion, were we right to just look the other way when there was just a little bit of kind of hot war happening and on the edges of Ukraine, sort of skirmishing before the Russians decided that no one was coming to Ukraine's help? Perhaps at that stage we should have been clearer that we would be prepared to. What do we do now that we have Donald Trump? And how can we influence him in the right way? Do give us a ring. I'd love to know what you have to think or what you think and what you think we should do next. I'd like to get to Alec in Manchester. Hello, Alec.
Hey, Emily. You okay?
Yeah, good.
Good. So I see Russia as a future ally, and a future ally of Europe and part of Europe. But for right now, we need to help the Ukrainians carry Russians out or get them to walk out. They need to get out of Ukraine, whether it's in a body bag or on foot.
And so, is it the whole of Ukraine? I mean, does that include...
The whole of Ukraine,
you know,
pre-2014.
Okay.
I honestly think we need to be loud and clear about what we want, and it should be regime change in Russia from the Russian people. Turn the thumbscrews on the economy and put him down like a dog.
Okay, so what do you think we should do in order to achieve that? So we put the thumbscrews on their economy, so that's sanctions. Well, we're already doing that. What else?
We can go a lot further.
Okay.
We can be putting secondary sanctions on. We can also be helping Ukraine sanction Russia's oil depots within Russia. We should be going a lot further. It's as simple as that.
Do you think we should be trying to encourage the Americans, or indeed assisting ourselves, to allow the Ukrainians to attack Russia?
Absolutely. I mean, we can say what we want to Trump, but frankly, we need to just stand on our own 2 feet and say, this is what we want, this is what we're going for. If you want to buddy up to Putin, go ahead. But if you do that, you're no ally of ours, and that's it.
But at the moment, the deal with the Ukrainians is we support them to defend themselves in Ukraine, but that they mustn't be attacking Russia, right?
And it's a bloody daft deal.
And there's been... Don't swear again. I'm not supposed to swear on live radio. But but there have been limited attacks by the Ukrainians on sort of depots, you know, where the weapons are. They've said, well, we need to do that because those weapons are being used to attack our country. But they've not been going very much further than that, and they are being held back by the Europeans. But your view is that we shouldn't hold them back and we should let them just attack Russia.
Yeah, they're committing genocide in Ukraine. They are destroying Ukraine in whole or in part. They are taking children. They are... What Russia is doing is evil.
Mm.
We talk about Gaza, and that's evil.
Mm.
This is evil as well, and this is right on our doorstep.
Yeah. I hear you.
We need to not be talking about the coalition of the willing. We need to be doing something.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alec. Thank you for your thoughts. Shall I go to Lisa? Let's go to Lisa in Southampton. Hello, Lisa.
Hello, Emily. How are you?
I'm all right.
Yeah. As you can tell by my accent, I'm American.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a Lithuanian daughter-in-law. And I feel very... I feel extremely upset because I knew this was going to happen. I'm a lifelong Democrat.
Right.
And I just knew that this transactional president, he can do nothing because he's not looking at the big picture. And he also actually doesn't know anything about Europe.
Mm.
He has no idea about the history, and he has no idea about the countries like the Baltic countries, which I'm extremely concerned about.
Mm.
Because when you talked about Kaliningrad, that's only 100 miles from Klaipeda, which is where my daughter-in-law's part of her family lives.
Right.
And it's very Russian in part of those areas in Lithuania.
Yes.
Because it borders Russia.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult.
And because people were moved. And people were moved from Russia into Lithuania.
Well, yes. And the thing is, Lithuania, people don't realize that the Baltic countries, and Lithuania in particular as well, was occupied by not only the Russians, but the Germans.
Mm.
And so there was no area. And you know, they couldn't even under the USSR. My son's mother-in-law, she said, we couldn't speak Lithuanian. We weren't allowed to write English or speak English or be jailed. It was a horrible, horrible existence for them.
Yeah.
And they are scared. They're very frightened, and they're already building barriers. You know, there's a gap between Poland and Lithuania. It's 100 meters, and they are fortifying that because they know that if that is cut off, they are completely an island. They're completely surrounded.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard, and I don't think Trump is the answer. I don't like Steve Witkoff. I mean, when he went to those negotiations, he didn't even take his own interpreter. So the Russians could tell him anything and he wouldn't know what they were saying.
Yeah.
Whereas Anthony Blinken, with all his experience, I think that Biden was, his hands were tied because there was an election coming up. And people don't understand that in 2014, we were still in Afghanistan. We were still at the end of Iraq. We couldn't take on another war. So we forget that it wasn't as easy to actually stand firm when they went into Crimea.
That's a good point, actually. That is a good point. I was saying earlier that should we have said no to the Russians earlier, and perhaps by allowing them to take over Crimea in the way that they did, and to allow this kind of these skirmishes to continue without standing up to the Russians, that Putin was just encouraged by it. But I hear what you say. I mean, you're right.
Do something. He was president during the Crimea, mm-hmm. during the war, and he did nothing because it was not of interest to him. So I just think that people need to look at the history of these countries are all part of a commonwealth. Ukraine, everywhere you go in Lithuania, you'll see Ukrainian flags.
Yes.
In their museums, you will see the connection with Ukraine is very, very strong. And the Baltic countries are very, you know, they've come a long way. And I don't think anybody maybe will protect them if something happens because they're very small.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, no, it's good to hear from you. I mean, and you're absolutely right. The perspective of the Baltic countries that were occupied so recently is a very important one, and they're extremely nervous that they may lose their independence and that the Russians will simply take them back, and they will do everything that they can to defend themselves in these circumstances. I've been getting some text messages. I've been getting a text message from Shazad. If Ukraine is fighting our war, why are the USA and Europe, including the UK, drip-feeding weapons and that make a difference? Go to war with Russia and finish it. It will not lead to World War III. Russia is almost defeated. Okay. Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, but thank you very much for your message in any event. Good morning, Emily. A peace deal in Ukraine is not going to happen. The reason being that Ukraine will never accede to Putin's demand, which is effectively a surrender by Ukraine. Ukraine has made it clear that the return of all invaded territory is returned. They will fight on and Europe must step up. Europe's weakness in the whole issue came to the fore in 2014. Putin is laughing. Trump is a waste of time. He's totally clueless. Thank you very much, Nick. Well, yes, I don't know. I think that there is something about the potential for frozen borders. I hate to say this, but it may be that if we're looking at what might happen, and it will be up to the Ukrainians to decide, in my view, but it may be that if we're looking for something that actually will happen as opposed to what we want to happen, it may be that the borders at the time of peace will become frozen, as they are in so many places where there has been a conflict. There won't be agreement that Russia was right or that Russia should have the territory that it has so far, but it won't be allowed anymore. And then there needs to be some sort of guarantee that the Ukrainians will be properly defended if the Russians put one foot outside the frozen borders. That's not great news for the people who have wanted to be Ukrainian and have been taken over by the Russians and want to continue, you know, to be Ukrainian. And it won't be a great result, but it may be, if we're thinking about what realistically may happen, that is what may happen. We will see. I mean, you know, I want to stand with Ukraine and I want them to win, and I want us to continue to support them properly so that they are able to win. Let's go to another message. I've got another one from Sarah. I'm against our involvement. Starmer needs to sort out issues here and not get carried away by the kudos of what's morally right on the world stage. I don't think he and his team have a clue about issues here. Also, Putin is a strategist, long game personality, and Trump is an opportunist who loses interest if not winning. So our involvement would be useless, waste of British lives and money. Strengthening Europe is the only answer against Putin. Well, as I say, we're getting lots of different points of view on this, and it's really important to hear, you know, a range of views. So thank you very much, Sarah, for getting in touch. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. We've got a few more calls before the end of the hour, and the time now is 11:47.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
No plan has ever been this radical. To put it in context again, their plan essentially is to deport people equivalent to the size of a city of Glasgow during a parliamentary term. Reform UK MP and deputy leader of the party, Richard Tice.
Over the lifetime of a parliamentary term, tens of billions of pounds can be saved because we will remove the asylum seekers, the illegal migrants.
Mr. Tice, how comfortable would you be with the British government giving money to countries such as Iran, Sudan or the terrorists of the Taliban.
Sometimes in life you have to do business with people that you may not like.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
My beans have been to Mexico. They once went to Peru. My beans, they flew to Portugal, then went to Tuvalu. My beans were with me in Italy, then came with me to Greece. I slurped their sauce on Spanish shores. I nibbled them in Nice. My Heinz beans have seen the world. They've travelled far and wide because they are, as we all know, too good to leave behind.
OK, let me stop you there, sir. You still have to check them into the hold.
Oh, all right then. Honestly.
Beans means Heinz. As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Tough. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
When we're little, we don't overthink things. We're brave, confident, we laugh and ask questions.
And play.
And play. So why stop there? Just because we're adults, it shouldn't mean we stop trying new things. For me, starting a career in early years has meant not just a new job, but new skills, new friends.
Like me.
Yes, and a new sense of purpose. All that, and I can earn while I learn.
Yay, painting next.
Do something big. Work with small children. Search early years careers to find out more.
Buying a home on a holiday park was a dream that became a nightmare. High-pressure sales tactics, huge site fee increases, and a loss of value have left many customers feeling misled, angry, and trapped. But the Holiday Park Advice Centre can help. Contact us today and we'll help claim back any money you're owed on your holiday home. Text ASSIST to 78900 to get started.
Hello, Holiday Park Advice Centre.
That's ASSIST to 78900.
Julie could part exchange her car. Or check out We Buy Any Car. She could be unsure if she got a good deal part exchanging. Or have cash in the bank with more bargaining power to get a bigger car for her five-a-side team. Totally played. Oh, total player. To get a quote in 30 seconds, enter your reg number now at webuyanycar.com.
Emily Thornberry on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Good morning, it's Emily Thornberry. I'm standing in for James O'Brien on LBC and we are talking Ukraine. And we're talking about Donald Trump. And we're talking about Donald Trump, who sees himself as a peacemaker and who is attempting, I think, genuinely to try to find peace in a whole range of different areas, sort of simultaneously, really. But the question is, does he have the staying power? Does he have the attention to detail? Is he prepared to focus? Is he prepared to listen to advice? Many people watching what he's doing in Ukraine are concerned that he seems to say one thing one day and then a few days later seems to be changing his mind again. And it's quite difficult to watch it. Certainly he has a very interesting relationship with Putin, who seems to have quite an influence on him sometimes, and then at other times he doesn't. We are speaking on a day when he's introduced sanctions against India for buying Russian oil, for example. So he does this today. Who knows what he's going to do tomorrow? Is there strength in this unpredictability? Give us a ring and tell us what your thoughts are. I'm going to go to Mohammed, though, in Ealing in the meantime. Hello, Mohammed.
Hello. Hi. Good morning, Emily. I hope you're doing pleasantly well.
I'm doing well.
First and foremost, I wanted to say you do an amazing job for the UK and you're a great person on the Foreign Affairs Committee. And I wish you all the best of luck in the future.
Thank you. What
I wanted to say, Emily, is I think most people, Donald Trump is not their cup of tea. But I come from a point of view where I'm of the opinion that Donald Trump has saved the world from a catastrophe in World War III. I think that the trajectory matters were going under the previous U.S. administration and the West was, you know, was going to World War III more or less. And I think
Over what? Just to so that I understand.
I think we were heading to World War III. I think Russia and the West were on course to World War III, but
because of Ukraine.
Because of Ukraine,
okay.
I think my rationale for that, Emily, is that Russia was doing one thing, the West were doing another thing, and I think when Joe Biden provided the authorization to use those weapons before Donald Trump was sworn in, and the UK and other countries followed suit, was a escalation. But I think Russia didn't retaliate in the way they would have because Donald Trump was elected, and they were hoping that dialogue would start once Donald Trump came into office. I think the work that Donald Trump has carried out in terms of trying to defuse the situation and try and obtain peace is a good thing for the world and for the people like us who live in the West. You know, I'm of the view, you know, the more countries get along, the better for communities up and down the world. And I think at the moment, you know, the West are provoking Putin really, really badly, and he hasn't bitten back. And I think, you know, people say that no country should be invaded, and I think Ukraine's sovereignty is imperative. But I think Ukraine is a pawn and for the West to get closer to NATO, to get closer to Russia, sorry. And I think, you know, we've had the Minsk Agreement 1 in 2014, the Minsk Agreement 2 in 2015, and there has been different dialogues. But, you know, and initially, back in the 1990s, when I was a young child, when I came to the UK as a three-year-old refugee with my family, there was that agreement when the Berlin Wall went down that the West would not go an inch further to the east. But since then, the Baltic states have gone into NATO. Ukraine wants to go into NATO. And, you know, when George Bush was elected in his time, Putin wanted to join NATO, and there was that conversation during NATO. But, however, we have warmongers across the world who want war, because war creates, you know, creates weapons creates economy and money, and this is the crisis that the world faces.
Can you just pause a second? I mean, so what I want to know from you is this: is what do you think should happen to Ukraine? I mean, do you think that it can be justified that in any way that Russia invaded Ukraine? And if it can't be justified, what should be done about it?
I think it's not justified that Russia's, invaded Ukraine. That's plain and simple, because every country has a right for self-governance.
Yeah, and Ukraine has the right to join NATO if Ukraine wants to, surely.
But, you know, we have to look at things from a historical context, you know.
No, I don't think we do. I think we should allow countries to make their own decisions about themselves, shouldn't we?
No, I think that I think, you know, we have to look at things in a historical context. If we just say, right now, would we have, say, Russia on our doorsteps? Would we have ISIS on our doorsteps? Would we have Al-Qaeda on our doorsteps? Russia sees the West as a threat to their national security, and that should be respected, you know. But if you're going to surround Russia with complete NATO countries, they see that as a major escalation, you know.
Romania or Lithuania or Ukraine is not Russia. You know, they should be allowed. They're either sovereign nations or they're not. And if they're sovereign nations, they should be allowed to make their own decisions about their own future. It really shouldn't. I mean, we're not. This is a sort of colonialism, isn't it? This idea that Russia should have a say in the future of these countries, when these countries are supposed to be allowed to stand on their own two feet and make their own decisions.
No, I totally disagree, Emily. I agree with 99% of the things that you stand for and the things that you do, Emily, and I respect you in the highest caliber.
It's all right, we're allowed to disagree, mate.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I would have to disagree with you on this point. I think we have to look at things from a big context, and I think Donald Trump is trying to understand that. And at the moment, what's holding up matters is that Russia is concerned that Ukraine would join NATO. And unfortunately, we would not have ISIS, Al-Qaeda or Russia, you see. We see Russia as a threat. Would we have Russia on the shores of Dover or in Calais, or no, we wouldn't. We would see that as a national threat, and Turkey and Starmer would retaliate accordingly. And Russia sees the West as a national threat, and that has to be respected, and we need to have an adult conversation about that. But I totally do agree that Ukraine has got the right to self-determine its cause and its future. But if you're going to circulate hostile nations that Russia perceives to be hostile nations within their perimeters, you know, then Russia is deemed to react. And unfortunately, you know, the West has provided billions and billions, you know, of funds to Ukraine to do whatever. And there's been large scale of fraud, you know. And even last week we were here, Vladimir Zelensky's opened up, owns a bank in Paris, you know.
Well, where do we hear that from? I mean, you know, we also have to be very careful about, there's lots of different ways in which Russia proceeds, right? It doesn't just send in tanks. It doesn't just invade Ukraine. It also sends out disinformation and tries to send out false propaganda and, you know, does character assassinations. I mean, they have tried to do a character assassination of Zelensky, you know, for many years now, and have largely not succeeded. And I do think that if you hear, you know, information like, you know, oh, well, Zelensky has a secret bank account in Paris, I do think we need to take that with a large pinch of salt, which to a certain extent takes me on to the next subject, which is going to be that after 12 o'clock, we're going to be discussing social media and the effect that it has on it. Where do you get your information from? Do you think that it's right for youngsters to have social media accounts if they're under 16? In Australia, they don't. In Australia, they're going to ban social media accounts for 16-year-olds and under, because they want people to be able to get sources of information from elsewhere. They're concerned about the effect of social media on developing minds. Do you think that it has a negative effect on developing minds? Do you think that we should be having more restrictions than we do? At the moment, the UK has recently passed legislation, but we're going nowhere near as close as far as Australia is. So I can't wait to hear what you have to say. Do give us a ring, and we'll, after the news, be changing the subject and talking about social media and its effect on youngsters. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry, on LBC. The time now is 12 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, the Liberal Democrats have accused the maker of the weight loss jab Mounjaro of price gouging in the UK. They are calling for an investigation by the competition watchdog after LBC revealed a freeze in supply ahead of a steep hike in prices next week. Eli Lilly is raising its prices by up to 170% from Monday. Pharmacist Dervis Gurrell says he's seen a surge in demand since the price hike was announced.
We have had an influx of queries, and furthermore, influx of new patients that want to start the medication before the price increases that is coming to effect on 1st of September. Some of the existing patients that's been getting these medications from other suppliers have been rummaging through because they're trying to obtain as much as they can.
Eli Lilly says it manages the supply of medicines in line with legal protections to prevent stockpiling. A senior minister says he is prepared for a political fight over Britain's future relationship with the EU. Nick Thomas-Simmons says there needs to be a pragmatic approach to talks on closer alignment with Brussels on food standards. Talks on a permanent deal will begin this autumn. The Cabinet Office ministers told LBC that his opponents are offering only easy answers and snake oil.
And the message today to Reform, who said they want to reverse this deal before they even saw it, is why do you want to put those costs back on businesses? What we want to do is reduce costs on businesses, have downward pressure on prices, including food prices.
Mr. Thomas-Simmons has claimed leaving the ECHR would make it significantly harder to tackle illegal migration. It follows a call from the Labour grandee Jack Straw to decouple British law from the Human Rights Treaty. The former Home Secretary has warned the convention is being used sometimes to prevent being misused to prevent deportations. A Scottish Conservative MSP has defected to Reform UK. Graham Simpson, who was elected in 2016, becomes the party's only representative at Holyrood. And households across Britain are facing another energy bill increase from the start of October. The energy regulator Ofgem's raised the price cap by 2%. That's about £3 a month for a typical gas and electricity bill. LBC in the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 92.63. That's down 2. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 15. LBC weather. Many places seeing a mixture of sunshine and showers. A band of heavier rain moving northeastwards across the UK. A high of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Emily Thornberry.
Good afternoon, you're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. I'm standing in for James O'Brien on LBC. We've just got one more hour left, but in this hour, I'm really keen to hear from you about what you have to say about the impact you think the social media is having on the children of our country. In Australia, they've decided that they're going to ban social media for the under 16s, so they won't be allowed to have social media accounts. You can imagine what the social media companies have to say about that and the fight that has been going on the other side of the world. But the Australian government is determined. They've decided that they're definitely going to introduce these bans. So what do you think? I mean, what I find really interesting is that the British public, in fact, I think are probably ahead of the politicians on this. If you look at the statistics, the polling that's happened, I think that there's 36% of adults are firmly in favour of supporting a ban on children being able to access social media, but another third think that it's probably a good idea. So there's a majority of people who think that there should be a ban. That certainly isn't something that is being discussed at the moment by politicians. But the question is, are we sleepwalking into a disaster? What is the effect of social media on young minds? How much time do your kids spend on social media? And what effect is it having on them? We hear stories like people are saying that when it comes to English GCSE, kids want to be able to choose the books that are the shortest because they just don't have the attention to be able to read a longer book. I mean, is this really what's happening? Attention spans seem to be getting shorter. Is that, and it's on all of us probably, could we as adults be banning under 16s from social media? You know what your children will say. They will say, but Mum, you spend all this time on social media. Why can't I spend time on social media? It's difficult. It's a difficult one to put forward. But if there is a ban that's done by the government, then maybe that helps parents to be able to say, but you're just simply not allowed to have a social media account. I can lend you my phone to do X, Y, and Z, but you are not allowed to have social media yourself. We know that it's having an effect on girls and girls' belief in themselves and their own self-image because they see images that are simply impossible to attain. Of people who what they look like is impossible to attain. And how that's undermining the confidence of girls. We know about bullying that happens online. We know that many people, many kids, it's a shocking statistic, get their first access to porn through Twitter. What are we going to do about this? Will we look back on this time as being a time when we just allowed social media to just creep up on us? And we just took too long to regulate. And perhaps in years to come, there will be regulation and we'll wonder what on earth we were doing and what we subjected a whole generation to. Some of the polling which I thought was most really affected me, actually, was reading polling of Gen Z, the 1997 to 2012 age group. So people who have been brought up with social media. And they have very strong views about it. Gen Z tend to feel that social media has done them more harm than good. 39% say that it has done more harm than good. Only 29% say that it's done more good than harm. I mean, this is... And these are Brits who, throughout their childhood, have had access without there really being any restriction at all on them being able to. So 84% of them support a ban on the under-13s. This drops to 42% when it's under-16s. But this is the generation that know. So what do you think? How does it affect you and your children? Of all adult Britons, the majority still support banning under-16s from social media. 72% of all adults are supportive of this. So there does seem to be quite strong public opinion. I wonder where we will be in 5 years, whether the politicians will have moved, whether public opinion will become even stronger, what the effects will be of another 5 years of largely unrestricted access to social media. And we also have AI coming over the hill. At the moment, so many people get their information from social media, and there is a question at the moment of what you can trust and what you can't. But if we're going to start relying on AI to give us the information so that we won't even ourselves go to several sites and find out what the truth is, but simply get AI to tell us what the truth is, will we stop asking questions? Will we stop being inquiring? Will we stop being inquisitive? Will we look back and think, this was the time when we lost our independence of thought, our mind, our spirit, our spark? Or will we just be thinking, what does AI have to say about this? I worry about it. And I worry about the fact that we are not really having a proper debate about it. And we perhaps may find that the Australians are right and that we should have moved faster than we did. I mean, it'll be a battle, if that is what we want to do, and not just be a battle with our children. It'll be a battle with social media, who are themselves increasingly powerful. And, of course, we are a country that needs to grow, and we need to be looking to technology and working with companies in order to grow our economy. And this is an opportunity for us. AI is an opportunity for us. But isn't there a need for some sort of protection, particularly protection for youngsters? Let me go to Sam in Southampton. Hello, Sam.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Right, my point on this, and I've had this conversation with a lot of people, I'm a teacher for some context.
Okay, good.
I don't have any social media myself. I'm not a huge fan of it. But I think often when we have these conversations, we miss the point. I think the main issue here is smartphones and the fact that they bring basically constant access to this material, wherever you are, whatever you're currently doing. I'd make the point that if we think back to things like video games, when Grand Theft Auto kind of became a big thing, people were up in arms saying this is going to cause X, Y, Z problems. And I don't think it did. And I think the reason for that is people didn't have constant access to it. They could get on it at home, but they couldn't get it on it every minute of every day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if it were up to me, I would personally ban smartphones.
Just ban them completely? For everybody or for under-16s? Or what are you saying?
Under-16s.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, what's it like at school? I mean, have you seen a difference? How long have you been a teacher? Do you mind me asking?
I'm about to start my 9th year.
Okay. So how have things changed over those 9 years, and have phones been part of those changes?
I'd say yes. I think attention spans are definitely a problem. I think that would be the main one. COVID obviously had a huge impact. I'd say that when kids are at school, most schools that I know certainly have a ban on phones.
Mm-hmm.
They enforce it in different ways. Either kids hand it in at the start of the day and it goes in a locker, or it's just not allowed out at all during the school day. And so, you know, kids aren't on them at schools, but I'd kind of liken it to, well, phones are designed to be addictive, right?
Mm.
So you take kids away from something that they're addicted to for 6 hours a day. And of course, there's going to be more problems if they can't get that fix of, you know, being on their phone, doing whatever it is on it. So, yeah, it's more challenging, yeah.
And what about when they need to do some research? Do they do it? I mean, I'm a terrible old fogey, but I remember I used to look at books. I used to look things up in encyclopedias. I mean, and like nobody argued with Encyclopedia Britannica that it wasn't true. Whereas if people go online, I mean, how do you teach children about what can be true and what might not be true? When how do you manage to navigate through that? Is there a way that we can help? In fact, do we know ourselves?
It's a difficult one. I think the challenge is that we don't know at the end of the day where kids are getting their news from, where they're getting their information from. You know, we could give a really good, effective bit of input on Facebook and how it, you know, channels ads and news in a certain way. But if they're not getting their news there, if they're getting it on Instagram or TikTok or anywhere else, YouTube, then, you know, we're always kind of going to be a little bit behind. I think we do actually give a fair amount of input to kids on, you know, misinformation, these are things you need to look out for. But it's always going to be challenging when there is so much of it. And, you know, kids, everyone to an extent believes what they want to believe. So if you see something that reinforces your worldview, you're less likely to dig into it as opposed to something which doesn't.
Yeah, but also the algorithms set, you know, work on the idea of, well, she likes this, let's send her more of that. So if you look at a story from one particular angle, the algorithm will not give you the other point of view. It'll give you more of that. And then you end up with people getting into, you know, just falling down a hole, don't you?
Yeah, sure, I get that. But I think the majority of people who are using social media aren't becoming radicalized to the extent where they go and commit violent crime, for example. That isn't happening for the majority of cases. Some cases, yeah, and it's a problem because of those few cases. But most people, I think, are using social media they're trying to use it in a relatively innocent way to look at relatively innocent things. And yes, the algorithm will definitely promote things that are more extreme because that's how it gets your attention. But I think the problem is the constant access to it. And I'd argue that constant access to pretty much anything is always going to be a bad thing. And that constant access comes from the smartphone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, thank you very much. That's a good point. Thank you very much, Sam. It's great to have heard from you. So should children be banned from using social media in this country? What impact is it having on your child? Call me on 0345 60 60 973. You're listening to me, Emily Thornbury. The time is now 12:15.
This is LBC.
With over 50 years experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
It's Munich, 1936, and all eyes are on the capital for the upcoming Olympic Games. As athletes fight for gold and the Nazis fight for power, Detective Sebastian Wolf faces a battle of his own. In a search that will take him from high society to the city's darkest corners, Wolf is about to learn just how easily the hunter becomes the hunted. Evil in High Places is the gripping new historical thriller from the million-copy bestseller Rory Clements. Out now in hardback, ebook, and in audio.
With UK Export Finance, I'm fulfilling more export orders from around the world with working capital support.
Export insurance means I'll get paid when exporting to challenging markets.
At UK Export Finance, we believe no viable UK export should fail for lack of finance or insurance. Between 2023 and 2024, we provided £8.8 billion of government-backed trade finance to support UK exports. Learn how we could help you win export contracts, fulfil orders and get paid. Search UK Export Finance today.
Emily Thornbury on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Good afternoon. You're listening to me, Emily Thornbury, on LBC. We're asking the question, should social media be banned for those who are 16 and under, as they are about to do in Australia? What is the effect of social media on your kids? Do tell us. I'm going to go to Elliot in Woodford. Hello, Elliot. What do you want to say?
Hello.
Hi, Emily. I we wouldn't let under 16s into casinos, which are designed and hardwired to exploit. So I don't know why we're allowing it for social media. And I've been battling this idea a little bit myself over the last, we adopted earlier this year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So I suppose there was the same discussions a few years ago around whether telly was good for kids, but I think that's changed a lot, because I remember haggling with my mother, like, early days, like, can I watch the telly? Everyone else is watching the telly, and whether there's a computer. But I think the sophistication of the algorithms has come a long way since we was watching 2D cartoons in black and white.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I know, I hear you. Well, yes, but I mean, if I was a 14-year-old, I'd probably say, yeah, but you come from a different age, Mum. The current world is so different, you just don't understand. I mean, how do we answer that?
Well, are you putting them at disadvantage because they'll be the anomaly because they've got longer attention spans versus their peers? And are we going into a world and we're ill-preparing them because they've got these longer attention spans, but actually they don't need a long attention span in the world of AI and ChatGPT?
Yeah, but also, will we end up in a world where people just don't ask questions anymore, and don't inquire, and don't say, well, are you sure that's right? Mm. Yeah, in the way that you really ought to be able to. And what will the effect of AI be on us in the end? That's the worry for me.
Mm. But totally with the Aussies, me.
Listen, thank you very much. Thank you for calling. Thank you, Elliot. Thank you for your time. I got a message from Lauren, actually, who says, on the impact of AI, on what it will have on us, I think a large number of us will stop asking questions, and the proportion who no longer ask questions will become the targets of billionaires who want to monopolise truth through AI. Andrew saying, Emily, TikTok videos, etc., are undermining faith in our institutions. For example, in videos, people are rude and confrontational to the police just for content. Likewise, videos constantly mock our politicians of all parties in some horrendous ways. Social media, unless checked, will undermine our whole society eventually. And I wonder whether the polarisation of politics might be at least to some extent the product of social media and the way in which people can fall down rabbit holes. If you look at one particular post, you can then get the same one and it gets worse and worse. And the way in which social media feeds on outrage, perhaps that's one of the reasons why the centre of politics is losing support in the way that it is, and people are going to the extremes. I mean, there may be many reasons, but I do wonder about the political effect of it. And I've got this message from Martin. Unfortunately, banning social media won't work. There are too many parents who'd rather their children have socials instead of dealing with the fallout of not having it. Well, yes, Martin, I understand that. But that's the reason why it needs to be legislation, and parents may feel that they are empowered by the fact that they're able to say to their kids, yeah, but it's illegal. You can't have a social media account. I'm sorry, but it's the law. And even if some kids get round it in Australia, nevertheless, the baseline will be something which people will know that youngsters ought not to have social media accounts until they're old enough to be able to cope with it. Then there's the question, are we old enough to cope with it? When are you able to cope with it? Let me go to John in Preston. Hello, John.
Hello, Emily. I'll just use three letters, VPN. Mohammed Zia Youssef of Reform UK said that's where the young people get around the Online Harms Act.
Yes.
And that's exactly the way. It's not possible to enforce it. How will you, and if your party decided to make this law, how would you enforce it? Because it's impossible to enforce. It's an American company, so UK law doesn't apply. Mm. Apple have already said, we're not going to give you our encryption methods to get around the Online Harms Act. 4chan, that's C-H-A-N, they're not complying to the Online Harms Act. So all these American companies are just ignoring you. So how will you enforce it with VPNs and such like? You could, okay, you could put on UK web providers, or you have to prove you're 18. Okay, prove you're 18. But you just load your VPN up and go that way. You say you're in Bangkok or Japan or somewhere else, the youngsters are more intelligent than we are. And that's what was wrong with your online safety bill. You, I'm not having a go at you. The all whole right. of Parliament yeah. were people that were tech savvy probably in the 80s and 90s and the 20th century dealing with the 21st century issue. And the online harms bills are full of holes. And the three letters VPM just are an example.
So, I mean, I understand what you're saying about VPN, about the online safety bill, and certainly a number of people have spoken to me about concerns about it. But I mean, I just kind of just take us back to the Australia point, which is 16-year-olds and under not having social media accounts. I mean, let's see how the Australians enforce it. I mean, I think one of the ways is that they've said that there needs to be a camera. That there needs to be, you need to prove who you are by, or what age you are by, you know, photographs being taken from the site. And obviously some people don't look older than they actually are, and there will be exceptions. But as a principle, for a country to kind of stand up and say there should be some restrictions on social media, I mean, is that a bad thing? By itself, just because it's going to be hard, just because something's going to be hard, does it mean that we shouldn't try to do it when it potentially might be so harmful?
What I would say to that, there may be potential harms there, but there are benefits to it. For example, yes. if you're at school and you're having trouble with your homework, for example, you could go onto Facebook Messenger, message people in your classes, how do I get around this problem?
Well, you could just ring them up. I mean, I remember I used to do that.
We've got to think like 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds.
Yeah, but if we're thinking like 13-year-olds in a country that's banned social media for 16-year-olds and under, then they're going to have to ring each other up, aren't they?
Yeah, but you're still thinking in the terms of 20th century technology.
I am.
We're not in the 20th century anymore. We're in the 21st century. And this thing about photographs, well, you know, people could just stick a piece of paper in front of a photograph in front of a camera and say it's them. Right. And they look clearly older.
We'll watch carefully what happens in Australia, John. I think it'll be really interesting to see, and let's see what happens next. But thank you very much for your call and for your thoughts. Let me go to Ian in Callington. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Emily. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. What do you have to say?
It's just, I think behind all this, my thinking is, at the moment we're talking about decisions that are being made in terms of how technology is used and deployed. And all those decisions are being made by tech billionaires who are driven by profit and growth.
Yeah,
I feel that I would rather have decisions like that made by the people that I voted in to run our society, folks like yourselves.
Okay.
So why are we just accepting what is happening to us because folks are making it that way because they're driving profit? So I fully support the Australians. Good for them. Mm. My brother's a teacher, and he tells us regularly that kids are coming in with much less, as you've already said in the program, much less attention span. And this can be stopped. It's happening because of the wide use and unrestricted use of technology in youngsters, in my opinion.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, thank you very much. Thank you for calling. So I've got to hear a message from Rose, and it's this. Hi, Emily. Absolutely agree with Australia. We've survived 300,000 years as humans without the internet, minus the last 40 years. I'm sure the under-16s will cope after they get over their mini meltdown. Okay, thank you. Let me go to Darren in Whitechapel. Hello, Darren. Are you there?
Hello, Emily.
Hello, Darren. How are you doing?
Yeah, I am. The thing is, though, with Australia... I'm okay. With what Australia are going to do, they also want to bring YouTube and Facebook and other tech companies. And the thing is, those companies are going to be... have already brought about trying to bring legal charges against the government as well.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. I don't think it's going to necessarily be easy for the Australians. I'm sure that these tech companies will not go down without fight. because it's very important for business, isn't it? For them to be able to have access to these youngsters. But you know, maybe they won't win. I mean, maybe, you know, the government in Australia will simply make sure that they have a watertight law that can't be challenged in the courts. Are you still there, Darren? I think I've lost you, Darren. Sorry. Let me go to Ken in Orpington.
Hello there.
Hello. Hello, Ken.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. You're a teacher.
Yeah, I've done sort of English teaching as a second language. So I've met teenagers through to 80-year-old Buddhist monks. I taught in a Buddhist monastery in Tibet.
Even they're
on their phones.
They're
on
not.
The table.
Don't
they
tell
are,
me Buddhist
sorry.
Monks are on their phones.
Yeah,
my goodness.
Sorry.
Wow.
And I use ChatGPT myself. I sort of design things. I write lyrics, etc., etc. But I was shocked by hearing, you know, Stephen Bartlett from Dragon's Den?
Oh, yes.
He had two neurosurgeons on, and they reported, it was a small sample of 60 MIT PhD level students, 3-month trial. One group could only use Google as the internet. Mm-hmm. One used ChatGPT. The other had to come from their own brains. And 3 months of PhD level essays to write.
Right.
And at the end of that study, they saw that the people who used ChatGPT had 53% less neural activity, which continued after the trial.
That's really worrying, isn't it? That is so worrying. Yeah. Good heavens.
I know. And what I'm finding with my peer group is I'll write beautiful songs set them to music. They love them. And then they say, oh, is that old ChatGPT? It's not you then, is it? Which is a curious thing. Because they loved it, and then they knew, but we are in a wave where it's gonna be a tsunami. God knows what the military have done with it, you know.
Yeah.
So I would beware of allowing it. And my goddaughter, I asked her, she's 22. I said, honestly, how much of your homework do your kids, your mates do on ChatGPT? She said, oh, it's just too easy, 95%. Then we go out partying. So you're not engaging your brain. You can use it, I would say, but be very careful that you drive the creative thinking process.
But how can you do that? How can you do that?
You have to be strict with you are the creative driving force. It is just a tool and you use it sparingly, I would say. But we're in a wave where it's not going to stop. It's just going to get better and better and better and better and better and faster and faster and faster.
But my point is about youngsters when they're trying. You know, when they're still growing, their brains are still growing.
Yeah, it'll affect that.
It'll affect them even more than the adults, even more than the Buddhist monks.
for sure, it will. I mean, they will develop a lazy habit of it's just much easier as well as ChatGPT. The answer to
maybe
anything,
it'll be even worse than a lazy habit. Maybe it'll be that they won't develop the ability to be able to distinguish things themselves, or to ask questions themselves, or to be inquiring. That's, you know, my concern.
The neuroscientist said you are setting yourself up for dementia in later life. No question about it.
Lord. Okay, thank you very much, Ken. On that encouraging note, you're listening to LBC and Emily Thornberry. We've just had Ken on Orpington talking a bit more about the impact of AI is already having on his students. If you want to talk more about this and predict what impact it's going to have on us and our young people, I'd be really keen to hear what you have to say. If you'd like to get involved in the conversation, you can call me on 0345 60 60 973. First now, though, the headlines with Dominic Ellis.
The Liberal Democrats are calling for the competition watchdog to investigate the maker of the weight loss jab Mounjaro. It's after LBC revealed a freeze in supply of the drug to pharmacies ahead of a steep price hike next week. The government says it will protect vulnerable households from rising energy bills this winter. The regulator Ofgem has raised its price cap by 2%, or about £3 a month for a typical gas and electricity bill from October. And a senior minister says he's prepared for a political fight over the UK's future relationship with the EU. Nick Thomas-Simmons says there needs to be a pragmatic approach for talks on closer alignment with Brussels on food standards. LBC weather. Many places seeing a mixture of sunshine and showers this afternoon. A band of heavier rain moving north-eastwards across the UK. A high of 24 degrees.
This is LBC.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet. Ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind. Tough. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
When we're little, we don't overthink things. We're brave, confident, we laugh and ask questions.
And play.
And play. So why stop there? Just because we're adults, it shouldn't mean we stop trying new things. For me, starting a career in early years has meant not just a new job, but new skills, new friends.
Like me.
Yes, and a new sense of purpose. All that, and I can earn while I learn.
Yay, painting next.
Do something big. Work with small children. Search early years careers to find out more.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips for the football?
Your best bet is to head over to BetVictor. They're giving new customers a terrific welcome offer. If you bet a minimum of £10, they'll give you £30 in free bets.
Oh, that's a steal of a deal.
It's a good darn deal that'll make you squeal for real. Neil?
My name's not Neil.
I know, but it rhymes.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on the football at BetVictor. 18 plus, opt in and bet on any football marketing at odds of evens or greater. No cash out, 7-day expiry. Terms and conditions apply. Gambleaware.org.
All those glasses are a great choice. And now you can pick a free pair from our Boots range.
Free?
That's right.
What, free?
Absolutely. There's hundreds to choose from too.
For free? Does the manager know?
I am the manager.
Oh, in that case, how do these look?
With buy one, get one free at Boots Opticians, everyone can save in style. Book an eye test today and see what's possible. Free Boots pair when you spend £150 on prescription glasses or sunglasses. Offer ends 23rd of September 2025. T's and C's apply.
Emily Thornberry on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Good afternoon. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. Australia is set to ban the under-16s from using social media, and I want you to tell me whether you think the UK government should be doing a bit more on this than they already have. How do you think British kids would react to being banned from social media? Do you have children yourself? What effect has it had on you, on them? Call me on 0345 6060 973. I've been talking about the Gen Z generation, who I think are particularly critical. I was very surprised when I saw the polling on this of just how anti-social media they are themselves. And of course, they're the generation that has been affected particularly by it. And we've got Aisha on the phone in Lewisham, who I think is a member of Gen Z. Hello, Aisha.
Hello, Emily. Pleasure to speak to you.
And to you. Go on then, tell me, what do you think?
So I'm 25, so I'm the oldest end of Gen Z. I was born in 1999.
Right.
And I spent most of my childhood reading books and watching videotapes and only five channels on the telly. But when I reached secondary school and puberty and adolescence, smartphones were becoming a lot more common. My opinion really is that social media as it was from, say, 2005 to 2015 was broadly a force for good. You had ways to keep in touch with your friends and family, sites like MSN, the early days of Facebook and Twitter. But that was then when they began to introduce more algorithms and started to feed you content from beyond your network. So in the early days, you were only seeing social media content from people you knew or people you admired, celebrities. And now there is a lot more of a push by social media companies to feed whatever retains your attention, and they feed you more and more extreme content.
Yes.
I would also make the connection between some of the protests we've seen outside hotels housing asylum seekers, mm-hmm. some of the misinformation that there is out there, and increased bot activity. It's so easy to generate content with AI that may not necessarily be rooted in real life.
Yeah.
So I find that the way the algorithms have been introduced quite insidiously has really led to this polarization through social media, radicalization, but also a bit of a dumbing down of what you're actually engaging with. It's made it more difficult to connect in the way social media was originally designed to do. And, you know, I'm very sad to say that while I devoured books as a child, I no longer really have the attention span to access the joy of reading, something I once found so much pleasure in.
Really?
Yes, and I think really we do have to grapple with how we take on big tech companies. And I know it's something very difficult for the government to do because of the power and influence they wield. But particularly mm-hmm. since Elon Musk bought up Twitter, mm-hmm. we are seeing a great deal more of this extremist content, but more of a push to undermine democracy, quite frankly.
Yes, yes. And what do you think about the Australians? I mean, do you think the Australians will succeed? You know, if they're introducing this legislation and they're going to ban access to social media accounts for 16-year-olds and under?
I think they probably will succeed. I mean, in actual fact, when I was at secondary school, we had unfettered use of smartphones in the classroom. We were able to use them to support us in our work. So from years 7 to years 12, that was the case. But then in year 13, suddenly the school realised, and I think the conversation had changed, about the harms of social media. And the school introduced rules that you weren't allowed to use your smartphone in school hours. And of course, the students who were getting most caught out by this were us year 13s who had been using it consistently for several years. So I do feel perhaps we have been asleep at the wheel for a whole generation of youngsters, and I think generally young people would benefit from having more restrictions on their access to social media.
It's so interesting to hear from you, Aisha, particularly, you know, given your experience and the way that you've kind of lived through the development of social media. I'm really grateful to you for ringing. Thank you very much. I've got a message here from Rachel, who left a voicemail, and she said, if all children learned a musical instrument, it would work wonders for their concentration. Music is a transferable skill, good for socialising, concentration, international relations, helping children with learning disabilities and healing the sick. Animals enjoy it too. So that comes from Rachel, who, not surprisingly, is a professional musician. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry. Australia is set to ban the under-16s from using social media, and I want you to tell me whether you think the government should be doing a bit more on this than they already have. Do call me on 03456060973. I'm going to go to Ian in Kettering. Hello, Ian.
Hi, Emily. I just wanted to make the point that I think that some people are looking at this in the wrong way, mm-hmm. as a kind of all-or-nothing switch. Whatever you do in government, whatever laws are brought in, you're never going to get 100% effectiveness. And when we look at things like video and game age classifications or banning underage people buying alcohol or tobacco, mm-hmm. there's always going to be people that will find ways around it.
Sure.
But what is the common good here? And doing something, I mean, although naturally I'm against these kind of restrictions, there's proof that there is harm to everyone, but especially young people. I think critical thinking doesn't really happen to the same level as it has in the past. And as Aisha made the point of people gaming the system effectively, whether that be social media companies or people using it as a conduit, there is a lot of harm that can come to young people. So I think that it's right that as a government you look at restrictions that can be put in place, because it will help a large number of parents resist the pressures from children. It will enable a lot of young people to be able to get a bit of breathing space away from social media. Granted, there will be those that don't find ways around it, but it will become less of an issue than it is today.
And would you be all right if those... I mean, listen, I'm just thinking in terms of a 14-year-old. Wouldn't a 14-year-old be saying to you, Ian, well, how would you feel if those restrictions were put on you? And why shouldn't you have those restrictions on you?
I agree, but what would you say to that 14-year-old if they were saying about people drinking alcohol, as an example?
Mm-hmm.
And that happens. And I think that what we have to be careful of is... And I guess this is where you as a government and your advisors and researchers come into it. It's about finding that break point. I think we need to be careful as a society of not making everything automatically 18-year-olds. Mm-hmm. In the past, people gained responsibility over a number of years because all young people do mature at a slightly different point in time, but you have to draw the line somewhere. And I think waiting until somebody turns 18 and then at the stroke of midnight giving them all adult responsibilities is a problem in and of itself. 14 maybe is a bit too young, but again, the research needs doing to find an appropriate line for social media. I think Australia is an interesting experiment to watch, but again, how long do you leave it? I think you posed that question earlier. But I think that somewhere from around about 16 is probably where you need to start giving young people responsibilities, and where social media fits into that, I don't know at the moment. But yes, for that 14-year-old, I think we do need to educate young people on the risks. I think we need to educate parents and the wider society as well. If I use an example or an analogy of the roads, when roads first started coming around and cars and motor vehicles started coming on them, I've got no doubt that they posed a massive risk to a lot of people that weren't used to them at that moment in time.
Yeah, and you had people walking in front of the cars with flags, if you remember.
Yeah, exactly. So have we banned cars or have we banned roads?
Yeah.
Or have we built a framework around it, including education?
No, good point. Good point. Well, good point. Thank you ever so much, Ian. I better get on because I've got my the board in front of me flashing. Let me move to Sam in... Sam.
Hello.
Hello, Sam.
Hello. So I was just calling, so I'm 21. I personally, with social media, when I'm older, I wouldn't want my children, right, because I've seen the impact it has on my generation, the amount of screen time. Even personally, I average probably 5 hours screen time a day. Some of that probably work on the computer. But it's a problem. You switch time. I think.
Yeah. Sorry, Sam, if you could ring us back on a better line. I'm just going to go to the ads in the meantime. You're listening to Emily Thornberry on LBC. The time now is 12:44.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Asma Mia.
Would you be comfortable for a British government to send Afghan women and girls back into the arms of the Taliban?
Asma Mia on LBC.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
Pump 6 in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My PP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Have I won a holiday?
No. PP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6.
T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Hey, love. Just spoke to Zara from St. James's Place.
Your financial advisor?
Yeah, we've made a plan. Retire early, travel more. Peru first.
Ooh, ¿cómo estás?
Bless you. And Zara's plan means I can help more with your house deposit.
Thanks again, Dad.
Planning for the future calls for invaluable advice. Visit St. James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St. James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
Tesco Finest Cod. A different kettle of fish. Pan-fried with garlic, slowly baked in butter, or finished with a squeeze of lemon. It'll get you hooked either way. It's why only the finest cuts of wild-caught cod are selected for our delicate and flaky cod loins. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores excludes Northern Ireland.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
This is LBC with Emily Thornberry.
Good afternoon. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry, on LBC. I've got a little bit of time to take a few more calls on social media and AI and the impact that you can see that it's having on young people. Before the break, I was talking to Sam on a terrible line, but I'm told that he's back on a better one. So sorry to cut you short, Sam. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I can hear you now.
All right, cool. Okay, so I'm so sorry that before we broke up, you were saying that you're 21 and that you don't think that social media has been that good for your generation.
No, I don't think so, because looking at my personal screen time, and I don't think I'm too bad, I'm spending 5 hours a day on a phone, which in my opinion is a waste of my time.
Mm.
And I think for generations, if you were like an Australian to ban it, if you grow up without social media, when you're older, you won't necessarily need it. If it was never there, you never miss it. I think that'd be very beneficial.
So you're one of that generation that thinks that it should be banned for 16s and under, because the Gen Z generation is quite stern and strict about this. I mean, I was just very surprised at how strongly that generation feels about it.
Well, it might just be a personal opinion. I'm slightly, like, I'm very mature for my age, I've been told, but I do believe that there is a negative impact in spending too much time and how it affects your mental health.
Right. Yes. Yeah. We haven't talked about the mental health aspects. I think that's a very important point. Listen, I'm so sorry, Sam, but your line even your better line is still bad. I'm going to need to move on. I'm going to go to Josh in Ludlow.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for taking time to talk to me.
Not at all. Thank you for me.
That's okay. So I'm 27, so I'm on the older end of the Gen Z generation.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent the best part of the last maybe 10 to 12 years really considering my own use on social media. So I was quite early on in that.
Right.
My parents were on the stricter end. So, you know, they didn't really let me have a smartphone until I was around 14, 15, and social media a little bit later. And I quite quickly found the impact of it to be quite negative. I think that, in short, I think that what Australia are doing is incredibly empowering, and I think it's a good thing. But I think the other side of the argument is that, you know, I think that what we got to do is we got to actually, if we're going to keep children away from these types of technologies as their brain is developing in that very neuroplastic stage of their life,
mm-hmm.
I think that one of the most important things to do is to actually give them outlets to develop things like long-term, you know, goal-orientated strategies towards life, sporting opportunities, you know, bringing back youth clubs, putting money back into arts and the creative industries. Because I think, you know, social media, iPhones, they're addictive at the end of the day. And if you don't give them that outlet, it's not just about the parents, but, you know, they're going to try and find it elsewhere.
I just hadn't thought of that. I mean, as we spend more time on, and particularly youngsters spend more time on phones, the alternative things that they might have done with their time are being stripped away because there isn't the same call for it. It's a very interesting point.
I also really want to just quickly caveat that, you know, these things, just like anything else, like a pencil and a pen, they're a tool and they can be used for positivity.
Mm-hmm.
So I've noticed that I think people that are in their 30s, or even in their 40s, I think that they're better able to use this technology as a tool without getting absorbed into it for the wrong reasons. And I think that's because they've simply had longer existence on the earth to actually develop as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you give it to young people before they've had a chance to find themselves, before they've had a chance to get involved in extracurricular activities and to develop social skills and go out and take healthy risks, I think that's where it gets really dodgy. So I personally, having spent a little bit of time in Australia myself and having seen what they do as a culture, I think it's fantastic, and I fully endorse it. You know, yeah. I see too many kids sitting around dinner tables when they're out, you know, around their phones. And I just don't, I don't get it. I think it's really bad.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you very much. That really thoughtful contribution, Josh. Thank you. You're listening to me, Emily Thornberry on LBC. I've got time for a few more calls on social media and AI and the impact that you can see it having on young people. And I'd like to go to Terry in Hanstanson. Hello, Terry. What have you got to say?
Hi, it's Kerry.
Oh, sorry.
But that's fine, don't worry. I'm a baby boomer, but I've got two more or less Gen Z children.
Okay.
One's 20, nearly 28, and she's a teacher.
Yes.
The other one is a manual worker. Mm-hmm. The manual worker, I think, spends a lot of time on all the social aspects as TikTok and other things, mainly watching sport and what have you. The teacher herself uses AI to integrate into her teaching, but she's also a dance and drama teacher. And that's a part of the education system that's lacking in the fact that performing arts doesn't seem to be particularly important. But by the same token, it is so important because it takes kids into a real world to be able to express themselves.
Yes.
And it takes away AI, it takes away keyboards, it takes away everything and it makes them creative. It made my daughter, as she was growing up, and she grew up the same as one of your previous callers, she grew up watching cartoons, she grew up going out with her friends, she grew up down the playing fields, etc. But as she became a university student and everything, then social media and all the other interactions on her phone became a little bit more important to her. But by the same token, she found so much more from performing arts as she was growing up with respect to confidence, being able to convey herself, being able to stand in front of people and actually
speak up,
etc. It's just something that is lacking, and it is lacking at the cost of, like your previous caller said, sitting at a dinner table looking on your phone.
Yeah.
But by the same token, we were on holiday recently and my husband remarked upon a table that was next to us and there was mum, dad and three kids all looking at their own phones. So it's something we all are guilty of, but I would fully endorse the under 16-year-olds not having contact with social media because they are developing, like you're again, the previous caller, got me quick before the post or whatever it is. He was saying about the fact that their minds need a little bit of risk, a bit of invention, a bit of imagination and what have you, and they need that before they get to young adulthood.
Yes.
So get rid of phones is the answer to that one.
All right, Kerry. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for ringing in. Let's go to Lisa in Hemel Hempstead. Hello, Lisa.
Hello there, Emily. How are you?
I'm all right.
Good, good. I was just touching upon this because my children were prior to social media. So when they were growing up, they were doing activities like squash, swimming, dancing, singing. So that, for me, grounded their energy basis of where their discipline lined. So when it came to social media, now, of course, there's certain parts of their career that relies upon that. And that's where I think it's appropriate for them, where they can now be entrepreneurs online because of social media. So I don't want to scorn it and make it a thing where it's all bad. It depends on how you give them the understanding of what they're opening themselves up for.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you at the table, you mustn't have this every minute phones. I think it's incredibly insociable.
Yes.
But it's a thing where now when it comes to AI, I was speaking to your colleagues and I said, I've gone back to university at 50 years in my life, at 50 years old, and they have a strict policy of, you know, you can't use ChatGPT, you cannot use all the other AI tools, Grammarly, etc. So what it was is that
How do they know? But if you don't pay, you know, you just go, well, but you just go off and use it anyway. How do they know that you've done that?
So they have installed a software which when you submit your assignments, that it pulls up But the thing is...
Oh, so they've got their own AI to fight your AI, have
yeah,
they?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay.
And it doesn't... And it's not absolutely correct because okay. I questioned it. I said, if I haven't used it and you're telling me I've used it, that something's not right here.
Yeah.
And then I wasn't the only voice in the university. So my point is that AI is incredibly useful for smart professionals who want to conduct a beautiful email where they don't, you know, they may not be, they don't want to become too personal, so they want to do it professionally. I think those type of things. You do have to have your own mind. You have to have your own interpretation of life. We're not going down the robot society, but we are going in the head of, this is where you pull back and you strike the balance.
Yep. Yeah,
you know,
I'm intrigued by this idea of you of the university having an AI hunter that's another AI that gets things wrong. I mean, it sounds amazing. It's a different world, Lisa.
And it's been questioned, it's been spoke about, and it's like. But remember, when you are doing work as a student graduate, like a young 16-year-old doing their examinations, or me as an elderly student.
No, don't say elderly, for heaven's sake. What does it make me?
I'm just trying to just say, well, I've got to go back and I've got the brain fog, right? So what I mean is that at the end of the day, we are all emulating what the prior predecessors put out there. So whether it be articles, whether it be journals, whether it be, you know, books,
Yeah. You
are still articulating back from that.
Okay.
It's just that AI does it a little bit quicker, and we are a instant coffee society. We want everything now, quick, done.
Thank you very much for your call, Lisa. I do appreciate you ringing. Just one last point, one last thought. I think the government having a strong stance is needed because there are so many seemingly intelligent people who let their preteens have smartphones and social media. Obviously, some would flout a new law, but I think it would be a wake-up call. The vast majority of parents won't intentionally be harming the children. They must honestly not understand the risks. So there we are. What an interesting hour. Thank you very much, everybody, for contributing to this. You've been listening to me, Emily Thornberry, on LBC. Thank you for all your calls today. Tomorrow, standing in for James O'Brien, it's James Cleverly. Coming on at 4 on LBC, Ben Kentish is in for Tom Swarbrick. But next, here's Asma Mir, and she's in for Sheila Fogarty.
Emily, thank you very much. Sometimes you have to do business with people you don't like. That's what Richard Tice of Reform UK said on LBC this morning. It's true, of course, but sending people, including women and girls, back into the arms of the Taliban, the very people they're running from, and paying the Taliban for it, how do you think that's going to turn out? And how comfortable are you with that? We are rightly very concerned about the safety of women and girls here in the UK. What about the safety of women and girls in Afghanistan? Not so much.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the maker of the weight loss jab Mounjaro has been accused of price gouging in Britain. The Liberal Democrats are calling for an investigation after LBC revealed a freeze in supply of the drug ahead of a steep price rise next week. Eli Lilly is raising the cost of Mounjaro by up to 170%. Ashley Cohen is from the National Pharmacy Association.
It has been a little bit like the Wild West here in terms of trying to get hold of the medication. I'm sure that will stabilise out post-September when the new price rise from the manufacturers kick in. We just want to assure our patients that we'll do whatever we can to guarantee the supplies to ensure stability of patients that are doing well on this medication.
Eli Lilly says it manages the supply of medicines in line with legal protections to prevent stockpiling. A Cabinet Office minister says he's prepared for a political fight over the UK's relationship with the EU. Nick Thomas-Simmons says talks with Brussels on a permanent food and drink deal will start in the autumn. Mr Thomas-Simmons says it'll deliver practical benefits rather than easy answers and snake oil offered by his political opponents. Reports found a 13-year-old girl who stabbed two teachers and a pupil at a school in southwest Wales was fascinated by war and Adolf Hitler. The teenager, who was also considered for referral to the government's anti-terror prevent programme before the attack in Ammanford last year, she was sentenced to 15 years in youth detention. Reform UK has announced a Scottish Conservative MSP has defected to the party. It gives Reform a representative at Holyrood for the first time since 2021. Speaking at an event in West Lothian, Graham Simpson said Scotland needs fresh thinking and new ideas.
I hope to be at the heart of helping Reform shape that offer to the people next year with policies drawn up in Scotland, for Scotland, and designed to fix the mess that we're in.
And the government says it'll protect vulnerable households from rising energy bills from October. The regulator Ofgem has raised its price cap by 2%, or around £3 a month for a typical gas and electricity bill. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down a point at 92.64. The pound bought $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather, many places seeing a mixture of sunshine and showers this afternoon. A band of heavier rain, though, will move north-eastwards across the UK. Highs of 24 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Today's another busy one in the Thing household. Mum's mowing the lawn. Dad's cooking tea. Ash is upstairs spinning tunes. And the twins are on a mission. Luckily, the Things are beating the price cap with a cheaper fixed tariff from British Gas. So, the twins can keep making sure the galaxy stays safe. Search British Gas Tariffs. British Gas. Taking care of things. Eligibility and T's and C's apply. To verify, visit britishgas.co.uk/verify.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Asma Mir.
Good afternoon to you. This is Asma Mir on LBC, sitting in for Sheila Fogarty all week. It's 4 minutes past one. We are talking very much still about immigration, and specifically, I suppose, about who you do business with and who you pay when you are talking, as Reform UK are, about sending migrants back to countries like Afghanistan or perhaps Sudan or Iran. Reform UK have been questioned about this, and it does appear that there may be some softening of the stance when it comes to women and children. We know that the majority of small boats arrivals are men. It's over 70%. But within those arrivals, there are some very vulnerable women and children, women and girls. And really, how comfortable are we? If we sit back and think about it, how comfortable are we with sending women and girls back into the arms of the Taliban, for example, the very people that they are running from with very good reason? You will know what kind of lives women and girls have in Afghanistan under the Taliban. Women can't work. Their voices are not allowed to be heard in public. Girls are not allowed to go to school after 12 years, after they're 12 years old. And not only did the idea seem to be that those women and girls would be sent back to the Taliban, that Reform UK might actually, if they were the government, pay the Taliban for the pleasure of returning these people to them. Now, there does seem to be a bit of rowing back on that, and we'll try to bring you up to date on that. But how comfortable would you be with the principle of sending vulnerable people, women and girls I'm talking about here, back into somewhere like Afghanistan, where the government, which is not recognised legitimately by the UK government, but where the government, where the Taliban actively mistreats women? That seems to be like a step too far, but I'd love to know what you think about this? 0345 60 60 973. Now, speaking to Nick Ferrari at breakfast today, Richard Tice from Reform UK was asked about Nigel Farage's speech yesterday, stating that they would pay money to countries like Sudan and Afghanistan.
Sometimes in life, you have to do business with people that you may not like. If we want a ceasefire in Gaza, you've got to do a deal with Hamas. If you want a ceasefire in Ukraine, you've got to do a deal with Putin. These are not nice people. But leadership is about taking difficult decisions. And I repeat the point. The role of the British government is to protect our sovereignty, our borders, and to ensure the safety of our women and girls. And that's why people are so angry about this. And that's why we're leading in the polls.
You're happy to send women back to Sudan, where rape is used as a tactic of war. You'd be comfortable with that.
And regrettably, some of these illegal migrants who have come to this country have raped British women and British girls. And the role of a British government is to defend the British people. Sometimes you have to do business with people you may not like. We cannot control despotic regimes around the world. What we can do is protect our own people. And that's what a Nigel Farage-led government promises to do.
Now, earlier today at a Reform UK press conference in Livingston, LBC Scotland reporter Rebecca Brady put Richard Tice's comments to Nigel Farage.
Thank you, Mr. Farage. You say deportation would help keep women and girls safe in the UK. Yet this morning, despite you just saying that your comments weren't about women in the next 5 years, Richard Tice told LBC, and he suggested female asylum seekers should be deported to countries where their safety can't be guaranteed, countries like Sudan, where rape can be used as a war tactic. Are you saying that his comments were wrong?
It won't be happening in the first 5 years of a Reform government.
But was he wrong?
That's just not our priority.
Does women's safety only apply to women in the UK for you?
Our primary target is to worry about women and girls on the streets of this country, less than what the countries are like that we're going to deport these men to. It's all about priorities, and it's all about, frankly, given the mess that we've had with this over the last few years, it's all about whose side are you on? Are you on the side of British people and their safety? Firstly on the streets, but secondly at a national security level, which I'm very concerned about? Or are you on the side of a series of completely outdated treaties and courts of dubious distinction?
So that's not completely clear, not to me anyway, because both Richard Tice and Nigel Farage make a very popular point that